Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
In other words, it may be comfortable to have a world in which you were given a role, you were given a place, and there are certain expectations that are followed. There's something that can be frightening about the realization you don't have to do that. But all boundaries are down. Freedom was not only the recognition of necessity, it was the recognition of possibility. So I think that what this book says throughout is that the system of white supremacy is always sending out dictates under the appearance of necessity. But freedom is recognizing, yes, there are certain kind of aspects of reality that have necessity. Gravity has a necessity to it. But white supremacy does not, even if it tries to define itself as one of those laws of physics, it is not. It is a creation of mere men. Again, as the vet says, recognize that the people that are operating this system are just people. They are not gods. And in that recognition that white supremacy is not necessary comes the possibility for its elimination. Now, in terms of a specific program, I think that Ellison, for good reason, and I think consistent with the insights of this book, is not going to come up with a program. The narrator of this book has been in a group called the Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood is a group that sort of, again, is an incarnation of the Great White Father. He talks about Brother Jack as someone who talks as if he's got everything figured out. He says there was something mysterious and smug in the way he spoke, as though he had everything figured out, whatever he was talking about. Look at this very most certain white man, I thought. That's on 290, I think, in the edition that Gus has. I think that there's, you know, in terms of what the actual program would be that this book would advocate, I don't think it wants to say that it doesn't want to give you, so to speak, marching orders. It doesn't want to give you a program of action. What it wants to do is let you know that you are free to pursue the possibilities of your own freedom, and that it is up to you, in fact, to cease to be a victim of white supremacy, to cease to be in a structure of domination and to move into a world of freedom, is to recognize that you are not under necessity, that you're not going to follow someone's program or order or directive for your life, but that you have to, it's your responsibility to make that program for yourself, to determine your own course of action. Again, I think it's, you know, this is touched on at the top of the show, but I think that in a very real way, you know, this book is a prelude to the kind of show that the Gussie Renegade has formed, which is about entering into conversation, trying to come up with things that are going to be useful or helpful for victims of white supremacy to work towards the elimination of white supremacy. In conversation, having people, you know, try to find what's valuable in the show and use it on their own. You know, I think Ellison's book is not about saying do this or do that. It's about saying you can figure out what you can do once you realize that the possibility of freedom is there.
Context of white supremacy. Gussie Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 29th, 2018, so I have been told. This is our ninth study session on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Gus T. Renegade's all-time favorite book. We are picking up on chapter 17, very beginning of chapter 17. Last week, main character, he gave his big speech for the Brotherhood, first performance at his new job. It seemed many of the whites, Brother Jack and company, were not pleased with his speech. They felt it was unscientific, all emotion, and he has been ordered to study under Brother Hambro to better learn the Brotherhood way. So that's what we're picking up at this week. I thought, importantly, as it ended last week, the main character, he was saying that he felt a greater sense of humanity, more human with all of this. And he was pondering what that even meant at the conclusion of last week, or the conclusion of chapter 16. The audio you just heard, that was Dr. Martin Kevorkian, author of Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America. He is a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. He's been a guest on this program at this point, like dozens of times. But that was from 2010. And we talked specifically about Invisible Man, his commentary relating to some of what we are going to hear this very week. That said, we will go ahead and get started. Context of White Supremacy, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, audio segment number one.
4 months later, when Brother Jack called the apartment at midnight to tell me to be prepared to take a ride, I became quite excited. Fortunately, I was awake and dressed, and when he drove up a few minutes later, I was waiting expectantly at the curb. Maybe, I thought, as I saw him hunched behind the wheel in his topcoat, this is what I've been waiting for. "How have you been, brother?" I said, getting in. "A little tired," he said. "Not enough sleep. Too many problems." Then, as he got the car underway, he became silent, and I decided not to ask any questions. That was one thing I had learned thoroughly. There must be something doing at the Thonian, I thought, watching him staring at the road as though lost in thought. Maybe the brothers are waiting to put me through my paces. If so, fine. I've been waiting for an examination. But instead of going to the Thonian, I looked out to discover that he had brought me to Harlem and was parking the car. "We'll have a drink," he said, getting out and heading for where the neon-lighted sign of a bull's head announced the El Toro bar. I was disappointed. I wanted no drink. I wanted to take the next step that lay between me and an assignment. I followed him inside with a surge of irritation. The barroom was warm and quiet. The usual rows of bottles with exotic names were lined on the shelves, and in the rear, where four men argued in Spanish over glasses of beer, a jukebox lit up green and red played Melia Luz, and as we waited for the bartender, I tried to figure the purpose of the trip. I had seen very little of Brother Jack after beginning my studies with Brother Hambro. My life had been too tightly organized. But I should have known that if anything was going to happen, Brother Hambro would have let me know. Instead, I was to meet him in the morning as usual. That Hambro, I thought, he is a fanatic teacher. A tall, friendly man, a lawyer and the Brotherhood's chief theoretician, he had proved to be a hard taskmaster. Between daily discussions with him and a rigid schedule of reading, I had been working harder than I'd ever found necessary at college. Even my nights were organized. Every evening found me at some rally or meeting in one of the many districts, though this was my first trip to Harlem since my speech, where I'd sit on the platform with the speakers, making notes to be discussed with him the next day. Every occasion became a study situation, even the parties that sometimes followed the meetings. During these, I had to make mental notes on the ideological attitudes revealed in the guests' conversations. But I had soon learned the method in it. Not only had I been learning the many aspects of the Brotherhood's policy and its approach to various social groupings, but the citywide membership had grown familiar with me. My part in the eviction was kept very much alive, and although I was under orders to make no speeches, I had grown accustomed to being introduced as a kind of hero. Yet it had been mainly a time for listening, and being a talker, I had grown impatient. Now I knew most of the Brotherhood arguments so well, those I doubted as well as those I believed, that I could repeat them in my sleep, but nothing had been said about my assignment. Thus I had hoped the midnight call meant some kind of action was to begin. Beside me, Brother Jack was still lost in thought. He seemed in no hurry to go elsewhere or to talk. And as the slow-motion bartender mixed our drinks, I puzzled vainly as to why he had brought me here. Before me, in the panel where a mirror is usually placed, I could see a scene from a bullfight, the bull charging close to the man, and the man swinging the cape in sculptured folds so close to his body that man and bull seemed to blend in one swirl of calm, pure motion. Pure grace, I thought, looking above the bar to where, larger than life, the pink and white image of a girl smiled down from a summery beer ad on which a calendar said, April 1. Then, as our drinks were placed before us, Brother Jack came alive, his mood changing as though, in the instant, he had settled whatever had been bothering him and felt suddenly free.
"Here, come back," he said, nudging me playfully. "She's only a cardboard image of a cold steel civilization."
I laughed, glad to hear him joking. "And that," I said, pointing to the bullfight scene.
"Sheer barbarism," he said, watching the bartender and lowering his voice to a whisper. "But tell me, how have you found your work with Brother Hambro?"
"Oh, fine," I said. "He's strict. But if I'd had teachers like him in college, I'd know a few things. He's taught me a lot, but whether enough to satisfy the brothers who disliked my arena speech, I don't know. Shall we converse scientifically?" He laughed, one of his eyes glowing brighter than the other.
Don't worry about the brothers," he said. "You'll do very well. Brother Hambro's reports on you have been excellent."
"Now that's nice to hear," I said, aware now of another bullfight scene further down the bar, in which the matador was being swept skyward on the black bull's horns. "I've worked pretty hard trying to master the ideology."
"Master it," Brother Jack said, "but don't overdo it. Don't let it master you. There is nothing to put the people to sleep like dry ideology. The ideal is to strike a medium between ideology and inspiration. Say what the people want to hear, but say it in such a way that they'll do what we wish."
He laughed. "Remember, too, that theory always comes after practice. Act first, theorize later. That's also a formula, a devastatingly effective one." He looked at me as though he did not see me, and I could not tell whether he was laughing at me or with me. I was only sure that he was laughing. "Yes," I said, "I'll try to master all that is required."
"You can," he said. "And now, you don't have to worry about the brothers' criticism. Just throw some ideology back at them and they'll leave you alone. Provided, of course, that you have the right backing and produce the required results. Another drink?"
Thanks, I've had enough."
"Are you sure?"
"Sure."
"Good. Now, to your assignment. Tomorrow you are to become chief spokesman of the Harlem District."
"What?"
"Yes. The committee decided yesterday."
"But I had no idea."
"You'll do all right. Now listen, you are to continue what you started at the eviction. Keep them stirred up, get them active. Get as many to join as possible. You'll be given guidance by some of the older members, but for the time being, you are to see what you can do. You will have freedom of action, and you will be under strict discipline to the committee."
"I see," I said.
"No, you don't quite see," he said, "but you will. You must not underestimate the discipline, brother. It makes you answerable to the entire organization for what you do. Don't underestimate the discipline. It's very strict. But within its framework, you are to have full freedom to do your work.
and your work is very important, understand? His eyes seemed to crowd my face as I nodded yes. We'd better go now so that you can get some sleep, he said, draining his glass. You're a soldier now. Your health belongs to the organization. I'll be ready, I said. I know you will. Until tomorrow, then, you'll meet with the executive committee of the Harlem section at 9 a.m. You know the location, of course. No, brother, I don't. Oh, that's right. Then you'd better come up with me for a minute. I have to see someone there, and you can take a look at where you'll work. I'll drop you off on the way down, he said. The district offices were located in a converted church structure, the main floor of which was occupied by a pawn shop, its window crammed with loot that gleamed dully in the darkened street. We took a stair to the third floor, entering a large room beneath a high Gothic ceiling. It's down here, Brother Jack said, making for the end of the large room where I saw a row of smaller ones, only one of which was lighted. And now I saw a man appear in the door and limp forward.
Evening, Brother Jack, he said.
Why, Brother Tarp, I expected to find Brother Tobit.
I know. He was here, but he had to leave, the man said. He left this envelope for you and said he'd call you later tonight.
Good, good, Brother Jack said. Oh, here, you meet a new brother.
Pleased to meet you,
the brother said, smiling.
I heard you speak at the arena. You really told him.
Thanks, I said. So you liked it, did you, Brother Tarp? Brother Jack said.
The boy's all right with me, the man said.
Well, you're going to see a lot of him. He's your new spokesman.
That's fine, the man said. Looks like we're going to get some changes made.
Correct, Brother Jack said. Now let's take a look at his office and we'll be going.
Sure, brother,
Tarp said, limping before me into one of the dark rooms and snapping on a light.
This here's the one.
I looked into a small office containing a flat top desk with a telephone, a typewriter on its table, a bookcase with shelves of books and pamphlets, and a huge map of the world inscribed with ancient nautical signs and a heroic figure of Columbus to one side. If there's anything you need, just see Brother Tarp, Brother Jack said. He's here at all times. Thanks, I shall, I said. I'll get oriented in the morning. Yes, and we'd better go so you can get some sleep. Good night, Brother Tarp. See that everything is ready for him in the morning.
You won't have to worry about a thing, brother. Good night.
It's because we attract men like Brother Tarp that we shall triumph, he said as we climbed into the car. He's old physically, but ideologically, he's a vigorous young man. He can be depended upon in the most precarious circumstance. He sounds like a good man to have around, I said. You'll see, he said, and lapsed into a silence that lasted until we reached my door. The committee was assembled in the hall with the high Gothic ceiling when I arrived, sitting in folding chairs around two small tables pushed together to form a unit. Well, Brother Jack said, you are on time. Very good. We favor precision in our leaders. Brother, I shall always try to be on time, I said. Here he is, brothers and sisters, he said, your new spokesman. Now, to begin, are we all present?
All except Brother Todd Clifton, someone said.
His red head jerked with surprise. So?
He'll be here, a young brother said. We were working until 3 this morning.
Still, he should be on time. Very well, Brother Jack said, taking out a watch. Let us begin. I have only a little time here, but a little time is all that is needed. You all know the events of the recent period and the role our new brother has played in them. Briefly, you are here to see that it isn't wasted. We must achieve 2 things. We must plan methods of increasing the effectiveness of our agitation, and we must organize the energy that has already been released. This calls for a rapid increase of membership. The people are fully aroused. If we fail to lead them into action, they will become passive or they will become cynical. Thus, it is necessary that we strike immediately and strike hard. For this purpose, he said, nodding toward me, Our brother has been appointed district spokesman. You are to give him your loyal support and regard him as the new instrument of the committee's authority. I heard the slight applause splatter up, only to halt with the opening of the door, and I looked down past the rows of chairs to where a hatless young man, about my own age, was coming into the hall. He wore a heavy sweater and slacks, and as the others looked up, I heard the quick intake of a woman's pleasurable sigh. Then the young man was moving with an easy Negro stride out of the shadow into the light, and I saw that he was very black and very handsome, and as he advanced mid-distance into the room, that he possessed the chiseled black marble features sometimes found on statues in northern museums and alive in southern towns in which the white offspring of house children and the black offspring of yard children bear names, features, and character traits as identical as the rifling of bullets fired from a common barrel. And now close up, leaning tall and relaxed, his arms outstretched stiffly upon the table, I saw the broad, taut span of his knuckles upon the dark grain of the wood, the muscular, sweated arms, the curving line of the chest rising to the easy pulsing of his throat, to the square, smooth chin, and saw a small, X-shaped patch of adhesive upon the subtly blended velvet over stone, granite over bone, Afro-Anglo-Saxon contour of his cheek. He leaned there, looking at us all with a remote aloofness, in which I sensed an unstated questioning beneath the friendly charm. Sensing a possible rival, I watched him warily, wondering who he was.
"Ah, so Brother Todd Clifton is late," Brother Jack said. "Our leader of the youth is late. Why is this?"
The young man pointed to his cheek and smiled.
"I had to see the doctor," he said.
"What is this?" Brother Jack said, looking at the cross of adhesive on the black skin.
"Just a little encounter with the Nationalists, with Ross the Extorter's boys," Brother Clifton said, and I heard a gasp from one of the women who gazed at him with shining, compassionate eyes.
Brother Jack gave me a quick look.
"Brother, you have heard of Ross. He's the wild man who calls himself a black Nationalist."
"I don't recall so," I said.
"You'll hear of him soon enough. Sit down, Brother Clifton, sit down. You must be careful. You are valuable to the organization. You must not take chances."
This was unavoidable," the young man said.
"Just the same," Brother Jack said, returning to the discussion with a call for ideas.
"Brother, are we still to fight against evictions?" I said.
"It has become a leading issue, thanks to you."
"Then why not step up the fight?" He studied my face.
"What do you suggest?"
"Well, since it's attracted so much attention, why not try to reach the whole community with the issue?"
"And how would you suggest we go about it?"
"I suggest we get the community leaders on record in support of us."
"There are certain difficulties in face of this," Brother Jack said. "Most of the leaders are against us."
"But I think he's got something there," Brother Clifton said. "What if we got them to support the issue, whether they like us or not? The issue is a community issue. It's nonpartisan."
"Sure," I said. "That's how it looks to me. With all the excitement over evictions, they can't afford to come out against us, not without appearing to be against the best interests of the community."
"So we have them across a barrel," Clifton said.
"That is perceptive enough," Brother Jack said.
The others agreed.
"You see," Brother Jack said with a grin, "we've always avoided these leaders, but the moment we start to advance on a broad front, sectarianism becomes a burden to be cast off." "Any other suggestions?"
He looked around. "Brother," I said, remembering now, "when I first came to Harlem, one of the first things that impressed me was a man making a speech from a ladder. He spoke very violently and with an accent, but he had an enthusiastic audience. Why can't we carry our program to the street in the same way?"
"So you have met him," he said, suddenly grinning. "Well, Ross the Exhorter has had a monopoly in Harlem, but now that we are larger, we might give it a try. What the committee wants is results."
So that was Ross the Exhorter, I thought.
"We'll have big trouble with the extorter, the exhorter," a big woman said. "His hoodlums would attack and denounce the white meat of a roasted chicken."
We laughed.
He goes wild when he sees black people and white people together, she said to me. We'll take care of that, Brother Clifton said, touching his cheek.
Very well, but no violence, Brother Jack said. The Brotherhood is against violence and terror and provocation of any kind. Aggressive, that is. Understand, Brother Clifton?
I understand, he said.
We will not countenance any aggressive violence, understand? Nor attacks upon officials or others who do not attack us. We are against all forms of violence. Do you understand?
Yes, brother, I said.
Very well. Having made this clear, I leave you now, he said. See what you can accomplish. You'll have plenty of support from other districts and all the guidance you need. Meanwhile, remember that we are all under discipline. He left, and we divided the labor. I suggested that each work in the area he knew best. Since there was no liaison between the Brotherhood and the community leaders, I assigned myself the task of creating one. It was decided that our street meetings begin immediately, and that Brother Todd Clifton was to return and go over the details with me. While the discussion continued, I studied their faces. They seemed absorbed with the cause and in complete agreement, blacks and whites. But when I tried to place them as to type, I got nowhere. The big woman, who looked like a southern sudsbuster, was in charge of women's work and spoke in abstract, ideological terms. The shy-looking man with the liver splotches on his neck spoke with a bold directness and eagerness for action. And this Brother Todd Clifton, the young leader, looked somehow like a hipster, a zoot suiter, a sharpie, except his head of Persian lamb's wool had never known a straightener. I could place none of them. They seemed familiar, but were just as different as Brother Jack and the other whites were from all the white men I had known. They were all transformed, like familiar people seen in a dream. Well, I thought, I'm different too, and they'll see it when the talk is finished and the action begins. I'll just have to be careful not to antagonize anyone. As it is, someone might resent my being placed in charge. But when Brother Todd Clifton came into my office to discuss the street meeting, I saw no signs of resentment, but a complete absorption in the strategy of the meeting. With great care, he went about instructing me how to deal with hecklers, on what to do if we were attacked, and upon how to recognize our members from the rest of the crowd. For all his seeming zoot-suiter characteristics, his speech was precise, and I had no doubt that he knew his business. "How do you think we'll do?" I said when he had finished. "It'll go big, man," he said. "It'll be bigger than anything since Garvey." "I wish I could be so sure," I said. I never saw Garvey." "I didn't either," he said. "But I understand that in Harlem he was very big." "Well, we're not Garvey, and he didn't last." "No, but he must have had something," he said with sudden passion. "He must have had something to move all those people. Our people are hell to move. He must have had plenty." I looked at him. His eyes were turned inward. Then he smiled. "Don't worry," he said. "We have a scientific plan, and you set them off. Things are so bad, they'll listen. And when they listen, they'll go along."
"I hope so," I said.
"They will. You haven't been around the movement as I have for 3 years now, and I can feel the change. They're ready to move."
"I hope your feelings are right," I said.
"They're right, all right," he said. "All we have to do is gather them in."
The evening was almost of a winter coldness. The corner, well lighted, and the all-Negro crowd large and tightly packed. Up on the ladder now, I was surrounded by a group of Clifton's youth division, and I could see beyond their backs with upturned collars the faces of the doubtful, the curious, and the convinced in the crowd. It was early, and I threw my voice hard down against the traffic sounds, feeling the damp coldness of the air upon my cheeks and hands as my voice warmed with my emotion. I had just begun to feel the pulsing set up between myself and the people, hearing them answering in staccato applause and agreement, when Todd Clifton caught my eye, pointing. And over the heads of the crowd and down past the dark storefronts and blinking neon signs, I saw a bristling band of about 20 men quick-stepping forward. I looked down.
"It's trouble. Keep talking," Clifton said. "Give the boys the signal."
My brothers, the time has come for action, I shouted. And now I saw the youth members and some older men move around to the back of the crowd and up to meet the advancing group. Then something sailed up out of the dark and landed hard against my forehead, and I felt the crowd surge in close, sending the ladder moving backwards, and I was like a man tottering above a crowd on stilts, then dropping backwards into the street and clear, hearing the ladder clatter down. They were milling in a panic now, and I saw Clifton beside me. "It's Ross the Exhorter," he yelled. "Can you use your hands?" "I can use my fists," I was annoyed. "Well, all right, then, here's your chance. Come on. Let's see you, Duke." He moved forward and seemed to dive into the whirling crowd, and I beside him, seeing them scatter into doorways and pound off in the dark. "There's Ross over there," Clifton cried, and I heard the sound of breaking glass and the street went dark. Someone had knocked out the light, and through the dimness I saw Clifton heading to where a red neon sign glowed in a dark window as something went past my head. Then a man ran up with a length of pipe, and I saw Clifton close with him, ducking down and working in close and grabbing the man's wrist and twisting suddenly like a soldier executing an about-face, so that now he faced me, the back of the man's elbow rigid across his shoulder, and the man rising on tiptoe and screaming as Clifton straightened smoothly and levered down on the arm. I heard a dry, popping sound and saw the man sag, and the pipe rang upon the walk. Then someone caught me hard in the stomach, and suddenly I knew that I was fighting too. I went to my knees and rolled and pulled erect, facing him. "Get up, Uncle Tom," he said, and I clipped him. He had his hands and I had mine, and the match was even, but he was not so lucky. He wasn't down and he wasn't out, but I caught him two good ones and he decided to fight elsewhere. When he turned, I tripped him and moved away. The fight was moving back into the dark where the streetlights had been knocked out clear to the corner, and it was quiet except for the grunting and straining and the sound of footfalls and of blows. It was confusing in the dark, and I couldn't tell ours from theirs and moved cautiously, trying to see. Someone up the street in the dark yelled, "Break it up! Break it up!" And I thought, "Cops," and looked around for Clifton. The neon sign glowed mysteriously, and there was a lot of running and cursing. And now I saw him working skillfully in a store lobby before a red "Checks Cashed Here" sign, and I hurried over, hearing objects sailing past my head and the crash of glass. Clifton's arms were moving in short, accurate jabs against the head and stomach of Ross, the Exhorter, punching him swiftly and scientifically, careful not to knock him into the window or strike the glass with his fists, working Ross between rights and lefts, jabbed so fast that he rocked like a drunken bull from side to side. And as I came up, Ross tried to bull his way out, and I saw Clifton drive him back and down into a squat, his hands upon the dark floor of the lobby, his heels back against the door like a runner against starting blocks. And now, shooting forward, he caught Clifton coming in, butting him, and I heard the burst of breath, and Clifton was on his back, and something flashed in Ross's hand, and he came forward. A short, heavy figure as wide as the lobby, now with the knife, moving deliberately. I spun, looking for the length of pipe, diving for it, and crawling on hands and knees, and here, here, and coming up to see Ross reach down, getting one hand into Clifton's collar, and the knife in the other, looking down at Clifton and panting, bull angry. I froze, seeing him draw back the knife and stop it in midair. Draw back and stop, cursing. Then draw back and stop again. All very quickly, beginning to cry now, and talking rapidly at the same time, and me easing slowly forward. "Man," Ross blurted, "I ought to kill you. God damn, I ought to kill you. And the world would be better off. But you, black man, why you be black man? I swear I ought to kill you. No man strike the Exhorter, God damn it, no man." I saw him raise the knife again, and now, as he lowered it unused, he pushed Clifton into the street and stood over him, sobbing. "Why are you with these white folks? Why? I've been watching you a long time. I say to myself, soon he get smart and get tired and get out of that thing. Why a good boy like you still with them?" Still moving forward, I saw his face gleam with red angry tears as he stood above Clifton with the still innocent knife and the tears red in the glow of the window sign. "You my brother, man. Brothers are the same color. How the hell you call these white men brother? Shit, man. That's shit. Brothers the same color. We sons of Mama Africa, you done forgot. You black.
Black! You... God damn, man! He said, swinging the knife for emphasis. You got bad hair. You got thick lips. They say you stink. They hate you, man. You African, African, why you with them? Leave that shit, man. They sell you out. That shit is old-fashioned. They enslave us. You forget that. How can they mean a black man any good? How they going to be your brother?
I had reached him now and brought the pipe down hard, seeing the knife fly off into the dark as he grabbed his wrist. And I raised the pipe again, suddenly hot with fear and hate, as he looked at me out of his narrow little eyes, standing his ground. And you, man, the exhorter said, a regular little black devil, a goddamn sly mongoose. Where you think you from? Going with the white folks. I know, goddamn, don't I know. You from down south. You from Trinidad. You from Barbados, Jamaica, South Africa, and the white man's foot in your ass all the way to the hip. What are you trying to deny by betraying the black people? Why you fight against us? You young fellas. You young black men with plenty education. I've been hearing your rabble-rousing. Why you go over to the enslaver? What kind of education is that? What kind of black man is that who betray his own mama? Shut up, Clifton said, leaping to his feet. Shut up! Hell no, Ross cried, wiping his eyes with his fist. I talk, bust me with the pipe, but by God, you listen to the exhorter. Come in with us, man. We build a glorious movement of black people. Black people! What they do, give you money. Who want the damn stuff? Their money bleed black blood, man. It's unclean. Taking their money is shit, man. Money without dignity, that's bad shit. Clifton lunged toward him. I held him, shaking my head. Come on, the man's crazy, I said, pulling on his arm. Ross struck his thighs with his fist. Me crazy, man? You call me crazy? Look at you two and look at me. Is this sanity? Standing here in three shades of blackness, three black men fighting in the street because of the white enslaver, is that sanity? Is that consciousness, scientific understanding? Is that the modern black man of the 20th century? Hell, man, is that self-respect, black against black? What they give you to betray, hmm? They're women, hmm? You fall for that? Let's go, I said, listening and remembering and suddenly alive in the dark with the horror of the battle royal. But Clifton looked at Ross with a tight, fascinated expression, pulling away from me. Let's go, I repeated. He stood there, looking. Sure, you go, Ross said, but not him. You contaminated, but he the real black man. In Africa, this man be a chief, a black king. Here they say he raped them goddamn women with no blood in their veins. I bet this man can't beat them off with baseball bat. Shit. What kind of foolishness is it? Kick him ass from cradle to grave, then call him brother. Does it make mathematics? Is it logical? Look at him, man. Open your eyes, he said to me. I look like that. I rock the blasted world. They know about me and Japan, India, all the colored countries, youth, intelligence, the man's natural prince. Where's your eyes? Where's your self-respect working for them damn people? The days is numbered. The time is almost here and you're fooling around like this was the 19th century. You don't understand you. Am I ignorant? Answer me, man. Yes, Clifton burst out. Hell yes. You think I'm crazy? Is it because I speak bad English? Hell, it ain't my mama tongue, man. I'm African. You really think I'm crazy? Yes, yes. You believe that, said Ross. What they do to you, black man? Give you them stinking women? Clifton lunged again, and again I grabbed him, and again Ross held his ground, his head glowing red. Women? God damn, man, is that equality? Is that the black man's freedom? A pat on the back and a piece of cunt without no passion. Maggots. They buy you that blasted cheap, man. What they do to my people? Where's your brains, these women dregs, man? They bile water. You know, the high-class white man hates the black man. That's simple. So now he uses the dregs and want you black men to do his dirty work. They betray you, and you betray the black people. They're tricking you, man.
Let them fight amongst themselves. Let them kill one another. We organize. Organization is good, but we organize black, black. To hell with that son of a bitch, eh? He take one of them strumpets and tell the black man his freedom lie between our skinny legs, while that son of a gun, he take all the power and the capital and don't leave the black man nothing. And the good white women, he tell the black man is a rapist and keep them locked up and ignorant while he makes the black man a race of bastards. When the black man gonna tire this childish perfidy? They got you so you don't trust your black intelligence. You young, don't play yourself cheap, man. Don't deny yourself. It took 1 billion gallons of black blood to make you recognize yourself inside, and you want the kings among men. A man knows he's a man when he's got nothing, when he's naked. Nobody have to tell him that. You 6-foot-tall man. You young and intelligent. You black and beautiful. And don't let him tell you different. You wasn't them things, you'd be dead, man. Dead. I'd have killed you, man. Ras the Exhorter raised up his knife and tried to do it, but he could not do it. Why don't you do it, I ask myself. I will do it now, I say. But something tell me, no, no, no. You might be killing your black king. And I say, yes, yes, oh, I accept your humiliating action. Ras, recognize your black possibilities, man. Ras would not sacrifice his black brother to the white enslaver. Instead, he cry. Ras is a man, no white man, I have to tell him that. And Ras cry. So why don't you recognize your black duty, man, and come join us? His chest was heaving, and a note of pleading had come into the harsh voice. He was an Exhorter, all right, and I was caught in the crude, insane eloquence of his plea. He stood there, awaiting an answer. And suddenly a big transport plane came low over the buildings, and I looked up to see the firing of its engine. And we were all three silent, watching. Suddenly the Exhorter shook his fist toward the plane and yelled, "Hell with him! Someday we have them too! Hell with him!" He stood there, shaking his fist as the plane rattled the buildings in his powerful flight. Then it was gone, and I looked about the unreal street. They were fighting far up the block in the dark now, and we were alone. I looked at the Exhorter. I didn't know if I were angry or amazed. "Look," I said, shaking my head, let's talk sense. From now on, we'll be on the street corners every night and we'll be prepared for trouble. We don't want it, especially with you, but we won't run either." "God damn, man," he said, leaping forward. "This is Harlem. This is my territory. The black man's territory. You think we let white folk come in and spread their poison? Let them come in like they come and take over the numbers racket, like they have all the stores? Talk sense, man. If you're talking to Ras, talk sense." "This is sense," I said. "And you listen as we listen to you. We'll be out here every night, you understand? We'll be out here, and the next time you go after one of our brothers with a knife, and I mean white or black, well, we won't forget it." He shook his head. "Nor will I forget you either, man." "Don't. I don't want you to. Because if you forget, there'll be trouble." "You're mistaken. Don't you see you're outnumbered? You need allies to win. That there is sense. Black allies, yellow and brown allies. All men who want a brotherly world," I said. "Don't be stupid, man. They white. They don't have to be allies with no black people. They get what they want, they turn against you. Where's your black intelligence?" "Thinking like that will get you lost in the backwash of history," I said. "Start thinking with your mind and not your emotions." He shook his head vehemently, looking at Clifton. "This black man talking to me about brains and thinking. I ask both of you, are you awake or sleeping? What is your past and where are you going? Never mind. Take your corrupt ideology and eat out your own guts like a laughing hyena. You are nowhere, man. Nowhere. Ras is not ignorant, nor is Ras afraid. No. Ras be here, black, and fighting for the liberty of the black people when the white folks have got what they want and done gone off laughing in your face and you stinking and choked up with white maggots." He spat angrily into the dark street. It flew pink in the red glow. "That'll be all right with me," I said. "Only remember what I said.
Come on, Brother Clifton. This man's full of pus. Black pus. We started away, a piece of glass crunching under my foot.
Maybe so, Ross said, but I am no fool. I am no black educated fool who thinks everything between black man and white man can be settled with some blasted lies in some bloody books written by the white man in the first place. It's 300 years of black blood to build this white man's civilization and won't be wiped out in a minute. Blood calls for blood. You remember that? And remember that I am not like you. Ross recognizes the true issues and he is not afraid to be black. Nor is he a traitor for white men. Remember that? I am no black traitor to the black people for the white people.
And before I could answer, Clifton spun in the dark, and there was a crack, and I saw Ross go down, and Clifton breathing hard, and Ross lying there in the street, a thick black man with red tears on his face that caught the reflection of the checks cashed here sign. And again, as Clifton looked gravely down, he seemed to ask a silent question. Let's go, I said. Let's go. We started away as the screams of sirens sounded, Clifton cursing quietly to himself. Then we were out of the dark, onto a busy street, and he turned to me. There were tears in his eyes.
That poor misguided son of a bitch, he said.
He thinks a lot of you, too, I said. I was glad to be out of the dark and away from that exhorting voice.
Man's crazy, Clifton said. It'll run you crazy if you let it.
Where'd he get that name, I said.
He gave it to himself.
I guess he did. Ross is a title of respect in the East.
It's one he didn't say something about Ethiopia stretching forth her wings, he said, mimicking Ross. He makes it sound like the hood of a cobra fluttering. I don't know.
We'll have to watch him now, I said.
Yeah, we better, he said. He won't stop fighting. And thanks for getting rid of his knife.
He didn't have to worry, I said. He wouldn't kill his king. He turned and looked at me as though he thought I might mean it. Then he smiled.
For a while there, I thought I was gone, he said.
As we headed for the district office, I wondered what Brother Jack would say about the fight.
We'll have to overpower him with organization, I said. We'll do that, all right. But it's on the inside that Ross is strong, Clifton said. On the inside, he's dangerous.
He won't get on the inside, I said. He'd consider himself a traitor.
No, Clifton said. He won't get on the inside.
Did you hear how he was talking?
Did you hear what he was saying?
I heard him, sure, I said.
I don't know, he said. I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside history.
What?
Plunge outside, turn his back. Otherwise, he might kill somebody, go nuts.
I didn't answer. Maybe he's right, I thought, and was suddenly very glad I had found brotherhood. The next morning it rained, and I reached the district before the others arrived and stood looking through the window of my office, past the jutting wall of a building and on beyond the monotonous pattern of its bricks and mortar. I saw a row of trees rising tall and graceful in the rain. One tree grew close by, and I could see the rain streaking its bark and its sticky buds. Trees were rowed the length of the long block beyond me, rising tall in dripping wetness above a series of cluttered backyards. And it occurred to me that, cleared of its ramshackle fences and planted with flowers and grass, it might form a pleasant park. And just then, a paper bag sailed from a window to my left and burst like a silent grenade, scattering garbage into the trees and pancaking to the earth with a soggy, exhausted plop. I started with disgust, then thought, the sun will shine in those backyards someday. A community cleanup campaign might be worthwhile for a slack season at that. Everything couldn't possibly be as exciting as last night. Turning back to my desk, I sat facing the map now, as Brother Tarp appeared.
"Morning, son. I see you already on the job," he said.
"Good morning. I have so much to do that I thought I'd better get started early," I said.
You do all right, he said. But I didn't come in here to take up your time. I want to put something on the wall.
Go right ahead. Can I give you a hand?
No, I can make it all right,
he said, clambering with his lame leg upon a chair that sat beneath the map and hanging a frame from the ceiling molding, straightening it carefully, and getting down to come over beside my desk.
Son, you know who that is?
Why, yes, I said, it's Frederick Douglass.
Yes, sir, that's just who it is.
You know much about him?
Well, not much.
My grandfather used to tell me about him, though.
That's enough. He was a great man. You just take a look at him once in a while. You have everything you need? Paper and stuff like that?
Yes, I have, Brother Tarp. And thanks for the portrait of Douglass.
Don't thank me, son, he said from the door. He belongs to all of us.
I sat now facing the portrait of Frederick Douglass, feeling a sudden piety, remembering and refusing to hear the echoes of my grandfather's voice. Then I picked up the telephone and began calling the community leaders. They fell in line like prisoners, preachers, politicians, various professionals, proving Clifton correct. The eviction fight was such a dramatic issue that most of the leaders feared that their followers would have rallied to us without them. I slighted no one, no matter how unimportant. Big shots, doctors, real estate men, and storefront preachers. And it went so fast and smoothly that it seemed not to happen to me, but to someone who actually bore my new name. I almost laughed into the phone when I heard the director of Men's House address me with profound respect. My new name was getting around. It's very strange, I thought, but things are so unreal for them normally that they believe that to call a thing by name is to make it so. And yet, I am what they think I am. Our work went so well that a few Sundays later, we threw a parade that clinched our hold on the community. We worked feverishly, and now the clashing and conflict of my last days at Mary's seemed to have moved out into the struggles of the community, leaving me inwardly calm and controlled. Even the hustle and bustle of picketing and speech-making seemed to stimulate me for the better. My wildest ideas paid off. Upon hearing that one of the unemployed brothers was an ex-drill master from Wichita, Kansas, I organized a drill team of six-footers whose duty it was to march through the streets striking up sparks with their hobnailed shoes. On the day of the parade, they drew crowds faster than a dogfight on a country road. The People's Hot Foot Squad, we called them, and when they drilled fancy formations down 7th Avenue in the springtime dusk, they set the streets ablaze. The community laughed and cheered, and the police were dumbfounded, but the sheer corn of it got them, and the Hotfoot Squad went shuffling along. Then came the flags and banners and the cards bearing slogans, and the squad of drum majorettes, the best-looking girls we could find, who pranced and twirled and just plain girled in the enthusiastic interest of brotherhood. We pulled 15,000 Harlemites into the street behind our slogans and marched down Broadway to City Hall. Indeed, we were the talk of the town. With a success, I was pushed forward at a dizzy pace. My name spread like smoke in an airless room. I was kept moving all over the place, speeches here, there, everywhere, uptown and down. I wrote newspaper articles, led parades and relief delegations, and so on, and the Brotherhood was going out of its way to make my name prominent. Articles, telegrams, and many mailings went out over my signature, some of which I'd written, but most not. I was publicized, identified with the organization both by word and image in the press. On the way to work one late spring morning, I counted 50 greetings from people I didn't know, becoming aware that there were two of me, the old self that slept a few hours a night and dreamed sometimes of my grandfather and Bledsoe and Brockway and Mary, the self that flew without wings and plunged from great heights, and the new public self that spoke for the Brotherhood and was becoming so much more important than the other that I seemed to run a foot race against myself. Still, I liked my work during those days of certainty. I kept my eyes wide and ears alert. The Brotherhood was a world within a world, and I was determined to discover all its secrets and to advance as far as I could. I saw no limits.
It was the one organization in the whole country in which I could reach the very top, and I meant to get there, even if it meant climbing a mountain of words. For now I had begun to believe, despite all the talk of science around me, that there was a magic in spoken words. Sometimes I sat watching the watery play of light upon Douglas's portrait, thinking how magical it was that he had talked his way from slavery to a government ministry, and so swiftly. Perhaps, I thought, something of the kind is happening to me. Douglas came north to escape and find work in the shipyards, a big fellow in a sailor suit who, like me, had taken another name. What had his true name been? Whatever it was as Douglas that he became himself, defined himself, not as a boatwright as he'd expected, but as an orator. Perhaps the sense of magic lay in the unexpected transformations. You start Saul and end up Paul, my grandfather had often said. When you're a youngin', you Saul, but let life whoop your head a bit and you starts to tryin' to be Paul, though you still Saul's around on the side. No, you could never tell where you were going. That was a sure thing, the only sure thing. Nor could you tell how you'd get there, though when you arrived it was somehow right. For hadn't I started out with a speech? And hadn't it been a speech that won my scholarship to college, where I had expected speech-making to win me a place with Bledsoe and launch me finally as national leader? Well, I had made a speech, and it had made me a leader, only not the kind I had expected. So that was the way it was. And no complaints, I thought, looking at the map. You started looking for red men, and you found them, even though of a different tribe and in a bright new world. The world was strange, if you stopped to think about it. Still, it was a world that could be controlled by science, and the Brotherhood had both science and history under control. Thus, for one lone stretch of time, I lived with the intensity displayed by those chronic numbers players who see clues to their fortune in the most minute and insignificant phenomena. In clouds, on passing trucks and subway cars, in dreams, comic strips, the shape of dog luck fouled on the pavements, I was dominated by the all-embracing idea of brotherhood. The organization had given the world a new shape, and me a vital role. We recognized no loose ends. Everything could be controlled by our science. Life was all pattern and discipline, and the beauty of discipline is when it works, and it was working very well.
Context of white supremacy. Woo! Joe Morton. Incredible job narrating the great Joe Morton. I'm so glad that now when I think of Joe Morton, I will not think of Scandal. Number one, I will think of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and then I will think of Terminator 2, which goes back to Dr. Martin Kevorkian, who you heard at the beginning of the program, and his dissection of the racism, white supremacy in that film. Again, that is a film where the main character is wearing a Public Enemy fear of a Black Planet t-shirt for most of the movie. But Joe Morton is in Terminator 2. He dies, of course, trying to help white people, but they blame him for the ruin of the world. I got to tell Dr. Kevorkian the cosmic irony that Joe Morton, he has a whole second in his book, Dr. Kevorkian, talking about Joe Morton's role in Terminator 2 and how it relates to racism, white supremacy, in his view. And he quotes Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man in his book to tell him, oh, by the way, do you know who does the narration for Invisible Man? Woof, the great Joe Morton. Incredible job. I'm in awe of his skills. Talk about skills as an orator. Wow, what a choice to have Mr. Morton do the narration. So we ended, we read all of chapter 17. We're starting the second audio segment on chapter 18. Again, my apologies to all the folks if you have been discombobulated by the schedule change, having the book club an hour earlier, but have yoga teacher training this evening once the book club ends. So this is accommodating my busy schedule briefly for this eight week period. That's it. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you would like to join the discussion and you do not want to use the phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it's tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a new window on your screen. First line is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line is the code 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that info entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. If you would like to participate, it is the same procedure. You will see a dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand. We will add you to the line and add your commentary. That's it. If folks have any thoughts, questions, things that stood out, I giggled so much. One of our listeners said way back when we began this book weeks ago, "Oh, yeah, is this why you don't like people calling you brother?" And I had totally forgotten about the brotherhood. It's been a while since I'd read this book, but it's like, oh yeah, yeah. There are many reasons why I do not like people calling me brother, but the brilliance of Ralph Ellison, he captures so many elements of white supremacy, racism, even my disgust with the term brother. Woo! Ralph Ellison, the great. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed. Oh, I think my switchboard is doing it again. So I went to open the lines up. Didn't work. I will refresh and we'll try again. So thank you for being patient. The technology of whites is not always spectacular. Let's see. All right. Let's see if it's working correctly now. It appears to be great. So if you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Hello, can I be heard?
Let's see, we'll get Jay in St. Louis. Greetings, Brother Jay. Just doing that in honor of the chapter.
Oh, yeah, greetings. Great to call in this week. I wanted to say, Gus, you pointed out something when this book first started. You told me to, you told all the listeners to pay attention to the speeches. And I've been doing that. I've been listening a lot more to the archives. And this week I was really able to take away a lot of the philosophical insights that Mr. Ellison gave us in this interaction between Ross and he's like my favorite character. I really identify with his orientation, but from his speech, I think it was just very insightful, the foreshadowing that he does when he talks about the illegitimacy of the Brotherhood and, you know, this idea that books written by white people, and in our day, I would say theory given to us by white people, can somehow explain our experiences better. And then very quickly, I just wanted to point out, the second part is apart from his encounter with Roz, the unnamed character, through it, Mr. Ellison is really teaching us about white supremacy. He's teaching us so much about white supremacy. Like, right away, he's telling you that white people will give you nice things. White people will put you in buildings. They will get you in contact with businessmen and nice people. And I think a lot of times that victims get caught up off of being an individual and running across white people who give them material things and mistaking that for a victory within the system of white supremacy. And as Ralph Ellison is letting us know through this beautiful narrative, through the speeches and then traveling along, he's really letting you know that white people have the power to do this and you shouldn't be caught up off of that. So thanks for letting me speak.
Appreciate that, Brother Jay in St. Louis. There were a bevy of folks. Let's see, the person at 9749. Did you have commentary?
No commentary. I just have a question. On page 285 in the book, it said that the character Clifton, he said, I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside of history. What did you, well, I'm a little bit, confused about that. What do you think he meant when he said that?
Great that's question.
Anybody can answer.
Great question. I am going back in my book in chapter 17 to that specific passage with Todd Clifton. In fact, if my memory serves, I think you are going to hear that again, that phrasing. I think you're going to hear it again before the end of the text. I could cheat and look ahead and tell you for certain, but, you know, hey. Yeah, we'll just pay attention and see if it comes up again. But I will pause. I will reserve comment to see if it does come up again. That'll give us something to think about. But yeah, I will reserve comment on that one. If anybody else want to answer the question, the phrasing again, this is Todd Clifton, brother Todd Clifton, with the Brotherhood, to see if I can give any more context. So they're talking about Roz, the exhorter, after the brawl in the alleyway, and the unnamed main character says he won't get on the inside. I said he'd consider himself a traitor. No, Clifton said, he won't get on the inside. Did you hear how he was talking? Did you hear what he was saying? I heard him. Sure, I said. I don't know, he said. I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside history. And it's an ellipsis. He doesn't finish. The main character says, what? Plunge outside, turn his back. Otherwise, he might kill somebody, go nuts. Woo! I did not highlight the plunge outside history part. I highlighted the next Clifton's next line. That's what I highlighted. Plunge outside, turn his back. Otherwise, he might kill somebody, go nuts. Now, I highlighted this because I know what's going to happen in the book. I know what's going to happen, unfortunately, to Brother Todd Clifton, foreshadowing. But, oh, man, knowing what's going to happen, that's what I chose to highlight.
You just gave us a spoiler.
Sorry, lots of them coming.
Oh, man. <Even the question.
laughs> Sorry, Brother Todd Clifton. Anyway, that's what I chose to highlight, but that is a massively, massively important section. And, oh, man, did anybody else want to – sorry, I'm giving my own little commentary. I will hush. Did anybody else want to answer the question, which was about plunge – outside history? I'll give you the sentence one more time. I don't know, Todd Clifton speaking. I suppose sometimes a man has, and has is in italics in this sentence. I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside history, ellipsis. It's like he's not finishing his thought. Anybody else want to give a response what that means?
Can I give one?
Yes, sir. Who's speaking?
This is Jay in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Brother Jay.
I think that means, I think it's like giving insight about black people who risk their lives for other black people. And during our time under this system, how they've been wiped from history, renamed as criminals, vandals, people who are not worth remembering at all. And so a lot of the times, you know, the stories of our soldiers, like Ryaz, that what he embodied, they don't get remembered. And, you know, that's what I took away from it. Thanks.
Appreciate that, Brother Jay. Anybody else want to give a thought to what Ellison means through the character of Todd Clifton? That's who's speaking when he says, I don't know. I suppose sometimes a man has to plunge outside history. And then his next sentence is, plunge outside, turn his back. Otherwise, he might kill somebody, go nuts. We'll wait and see if folks want to think on that one. This book gives you lots of opportunities to ponder things and, you know, see, oh, forgot, we see some other hands. Maybe some of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up have a thought.
Plunge outside history. And then the next sentence is,
again, a little echo. See if we get that. Other folks,
yes,
who dialed in.
Can I be heard?
Mr. I guess we'll nab Mr. Demery Four first.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers, listeners. I, too, had highlighted that part of the book. I thought it was interesting. And so I did a little research, and I believe the narrator asked a question later in the book himself, why would Todd Clifton plunge outside of history when he knew that the only way that they could be recognized, you know, as anything other than, you know, something useless, is that they stick with the brotherhood and make something of themselves. So it's almost like history is going on. It's not created in a vacuum. It's what you're doing that creates history. But it's ironic that it happened after they met Ryaz, and something that he said, I believe, influenced Brother Todd Clifton or caused confusion. So instead of being loyal to the brotherhood anymore, he turned his back on the brotherhood and went in a totally opposite direction. That's my assessment of it. Thanks, Gus.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. Did anybody else have commentary about the or a thought about what may be meant with this passage, plunging outside of history? We'll see. As folks are getting their thoughts together, any other comments about the first portion of the book? Are there any folks that we missed who had a hand up, who had commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, that phrase, plunging outside, I have to seriously think about that one. That was pretty deep. But in regards to the current readings that just happened, a lot of references to bulls and bullfighting, kind of a Welsing moment. I remember Dr. Welsing talked about how the bull is a symbol of the Aryan over the Negro in regards to a book she referenced, Serlo's definition of symbols. So lots of bull references in this particular reading. Spokesperson, the character was made the Harlem spokesperson. Something in regards to Mr. Fuller, regards to no such thing as black leaders, but only spokespeople, seems like correct terminology in regards to the system of white supremacy. And you know, ironically, Brother Jack giving him that title of spokesperson, white people not being confused about racism. The character Roz is a very interesting character. He seems like he's less confused about racism, despite the fact that he does display some attitude of anti-black behavior. However, Roz actually realizes this and is definitely trying to correct his behavior. So Roz is one of the characters, one of the non-white characters in the book who is probably less confused about racism, and he realizes that he still has some ways to go in regards to, completely understanding the system of racism, white supremacy. So that's all I had on me in my life.
Much obliged, brother. Roz, absolutely fascinating character. So much more of him to come. That's why I was saying last week, like, there's so many major characters that we've not met yet. So much more to come. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary. Any folks that we missed completely? Yes, Ivy, we can hear you.
Okay, was I speaking over someone? Was someone else speaking?
I don't believe so.
Okay. I'm just putting on my earpiece real quick to take away any possible background noise. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. I'm just pulling up my notes, which I did already. Okay, man, I love how excuse me, Jack, also known as so-called Brother Jack, said, say what they want to hear, but in a way that they'll do what we want. It actually reminds me of just how white people work in general. A lot of times you hear black people say, or at least I do, I hear black people tell white people, just admit, you know, that you benefit from racism. And so now, you know, that's what racists are coming out and saying, and they're even using that as a definition for racism. So it's like, okay, we will tell them that. We won't tell them how we're practitioners. We'll just tell them how we are recipients. And so we'll tell them what they want to hear, but we'll still tell them that in a way that they'll do what we want. So you're telling us that, but the way that you're telling us is you're using that as the only way that you are racist, which is not a way in which you are a racist at all. You're using that as the definition of it. And so when you're using benefits as the definition of it, then we'll do what you want. We will still not look at you as racist. We'll still not challenge you. We'll not ask you to go further and tell us how you're practitioners. And I think I wanted to ask you, Gus, did he say don't underestimate the discipline? Did Jack say that?
Don't underestimate the discipline, you said?
Yes.
Let's see. You will be under strict discipline to the committee. And then he says, no, you don't. Oh, I highlighted that. He said, you'll be given guidance by some older members, but for the time being, you are to see what you can do. You will have freedom of action, and you will be under strict discipline to the committee. I see, I said. No, you don't quite see, he said. But you will, Star Wars moment. You must not underestimate the discipline, brother. That's what he said.
Yeah, and I thought he repeated that over and over again. And so that made me think, like, is that going to come out more later where he's going to more expound on that, or that's going to be, how can I say, that's going to be, I guess, shown more down the line in the book, or unless I missed it in this particular section. But I thought that that was noteworthy, and I was kind of taken aback by the body description of, I believe it was Clifton or someone, just how he was talking about his muscles and all that type of stuff, and I was just kind of, I was tripping off of that. And one thing I was confused about, Roz, the character, let me know that, you know, I understood it correctly, that he is black, but then it sounded like he described him as Anglo-Saxon. Do you know what I'm talking about, Gus?
Let's see where the term Anglo-Saxon was used in chapter 17. Oh, are you talking about Todd Clifton being described as Anglo-Saxon? That's what you're talking about?
I want to say.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes, he did. I highlighted that as well. And that section, he says, leaning tall and relaxed, his arms outstretched stiffly upon the table, I saw the broad, taut span of his knuckles upon the dark green of the wood, the muscular, sweatered arms, the curving line of the chest rising to the easy pulsing of his throat, to the square, smooth chin, and saw a small X-shaped patch of adhesive upon the subtly blended velvet over stone, granite over bone, Afro-Anglo-Saxon contour of his cheek. That's all one sentence. Wow.
Do you know what that means in terms of, like, why he would use, because don't Anglo-Saxon mean white?
I highlighted the portion just above that where he said he possessed the chiseled black marble features sometimes found on statues in northern museums and alive in southern towns, in which the white offspring of house children and the black offspring of yard children bear names, features, and character traits as identical as the rifling of bullets fired from a common barrel. All one sentence. Does that add any clarity to why he would be describing Todd Clifton as Afro-Anglo-Saxon?
I think so. If I'm understanding, it's saying that, you know, that particular, his cheekbone or something like that was resembling of somebody white, because some of the black kids, I think he was saying, has white features, right? Okay. All right. With the cowbell, you know that? Okay. So moving on. Yeah, like what the previous caller said about how, you know, Roz, I love a lot of stuff that he said, but yeah, he definitely has some anti-blackness. It seemed like, if I'm not mistaken, he said you're black in that you have bad hair, and I think he even said you smell bad. I don't know if I got that right, but I'm not going to make you go back into the book because I'll be taking too long. And I like how he said, you know, we got to have self-respect. Like, it's not self-respecting for it to be black against black. Like, that was amazing. And I like how he said, white people, they get what they want, and then they discard you. And I think about how I even know some black people who are fooled by this. They have said to me that white people know that they better get with us because the government is going to come for all of us. Eventually, and they're trying to distract white people by using racism, when it's all said and done, they're going to come for all of us, and white people have told black people this, and I believe some of them even believe this, but the thing that black people don't understand is that you don't need to align with white people to liberate yourself and for the government coming for you, which they already are now, but I mean in the future or whatever, you don't ever need to align with them. If you want to align with anybody, align with non-white people, because you align with white people, you're going to help and fight their cause, and they may get victory or whatever, and then they're just going to discard you, just like Roz said, the character Roz. And I think he said that it's not self-respect to think that everything is okay between black people and white people. And I don't know if he said that's not black self-respect, but I believe he called out just this idea of thinking that everything is okay between black people and white people. And I thought that was profound, if I got that correct. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
For sure. He did say, don't underestimate discipline twice. He said it again after he said it the first time, just a few sentences down in the same paragraph. I was going to point that out, but then we were moved on to the Todd Clifton passage, so I turned the page, but I did want to get that in. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have any additional comments that you were going to share, sir?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I tuned in kind of late. I didn't hear the entire first reading, but I can remember just thinking all of the different scenarios that the narrator thought about in his mind, what could be going on with the Brotherhood. Excuse me. He never considered that the Brotherhood may not have the best interest of the people, and especially non-white black people in mind, and that he was just being used, as well as Todd Clifton, you know, to further their agenda. And he comes up with all these scenarios. It could be this, it could be that. He read the brochure or whatever, but he still could not get the true meaning of what the Brotherhood was all about and what's supposed to be going on. And for a large part of the book, it seems like he's just really trying to put two and two together and figure out what is the purpose of the Brotherhood. But I'll mute my line and have more after this second reading.
Much obliged, Brother Demery Ford. Are there any other folks that we missed completely who have commentary that we've not heard from, missed out on? Anybody else that we missed totally? Grant, I'll check again after I give my thoughts and see if folks have any other questions or anything else stood out. Let's see. I took quite a few notes. Brother Jack calls the apartment at midnight. Black people can't even get quality rest. Got to be at White's beck and call and to go out to get drinks, no less. He says, we'll have a drink going out to some bar. El Toro, I believe El Toro. The Bull, that's the bar. Ellison, the eloquence. I didn't even note that, but I'm a little retarded, but I did study Spanish. I just am a little rusty, but I do think El Toro, isn't that the Bull? That's the bar that we're talking about, the bullfighting references. That would be another, Dr. Welsing. I did make a notation of the bullfighting reference, the bull charging close to the man and the man swinging the red cape in sculptured folds so close to his body that the man and the bull seemed to blend in one swirl of calm, pure motion, pure grace, I thought, looking above the bar to where, larger than life, the pink and white image of a girl smiled down from a summery beer ad on which a calendar said April 1. The eloquence of Ellison. I think April 1 is April Fool's Day, what they call it. That's matched to a white woman in this beer ad. The joke is on you if you think that this is supposed to be about freedom or whatever, exactly what the vet had said, your opportunity to get some sort of symbolic liberation in the system of racism, white supremacy. And I thought it was significant, the bullfighting being paired with this image of what I think is a white woman in this beer ad, April 1. Violence and white women seem to be paired together consistently in the book. His incident on the train with the tubby white woman, the battle royale scene at the beginning with the white woman, and they're about to do battle. This scene seems like it's pretty consistent, unless I'm in error. Continuing. Oh, man, the scene with Brother Jack. There's so many moments. This is Brother Jack is not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. The scene where he's talking about disciplined and you've got to be a master of theory and science. Ellison writes, he looked at me as though he did not see me, and I could not tell whether he was laughing at me at in italics or with me with in italics. I was sure only that he was laughing. Oh, I have been in that position. That is the system of white supremacy being confused. Again, the great Dr. Kamal Kanban, when he says whites have us at a disadvantage when they know things we do not. That brilliantly described by Mr. Ellison. Continuing, we already talked about the scene that I highlighted. I just want to read it again. the genius of Ellison when they're talking about being disciplined. And the main character says, I see, I said. Brother Jack responds, no, you don't quite see, but you will. You must not underestimate the discipline, brother. It makes you answerable to the entire organization for what you do. Don't underestimate the discipline. To say it again, it is very strict, but within its framework, you are to have full freedom to do your work. Just you're going to be at our beck and call of whites the whole time through. I thought the description of Todd Clifton, I did think, was very extraordinarily detailed, eloquent, sexual. I had a lot of thoughts just about all of that. And I will apologize if anyone was offended by my spoiler. I will not give out any more details about what's going to happen later on in the book. However, if there is one spoiler that you might want, whew, things are not going to end well for Brother Todd Clifton. That is one that you might want to really pay attention to. What, even just knowing that and reading the few lines that Todd Clifton had in the section that we just read, you have a very different reading of that scene, knowing things do not end well for Brother Todd Clifton. If this is anyone's first time reading the book, or you don't know what's going to happen the next few chapters or so. No more spoilers, promise. When he's talking about Todd Clifton, before he gets into the description about whether or not he has these Afro-Anglo-Saxon features, he says, then the young man was moving with an easy Negro stride out of the shadow into the light, and I saw that he was very black and very handsome. Again, that's why I said he's kind of described in a sexualized manner, I think. But I have no idea what an easy Negro stride is. If anyone has a YouTube video, can demonstrate, can, if you are skilled enough that you can use your words to describe an easy Negro stride, I would love to be educated. Thank you. Continuing. I already read the, I interpreted when Ellison talked about Todd Clifton, when specifically when he says sometimes when he's talking about Todd Clifton's physique, his features resembling statues in northern museums and alive in southern towns, in which white offspring of house children and the black offspring of yard children bear names, features, and character traits as identical as the rifling of bullets fired from a common barrel. I took that as though he might have the features of a non-white person who has a white parent and a black parent. Now, he's already described him as being very black, that would lead me to think that he has, you know, a lot of melanin, but there might be things about his features that resemble a white person for some reason. Folks can check that again, read that again. If folks, you know, have a different interpretation or think that's incorrect, please share. But that's what it suggested to me. Continuing, when they were the Brotherhood, when they were talking about Roz, and the white woman said that Roz would denounce the white meat of a roasted chicken. Like getting the chicken joke and at the same time, Ellison, brilliant. Let's see. Roz did mention self-respect. Again, mentioned Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I think he's, next to the vet, one of the most honest characters in the book about racism, white supremacy that we have heard thus far in the book, addressing black self-respect and the absurdity of there being some sort of brotherhood with whites, particularly after everything that has happened and what they continue to do. Let's see. Where is your eyes? Where is your eyes? In a book entitled Invisible Man, very important. A lot of that in this chapter, people talking about you not understanding and saying you don't understand, you don't see, relating those two. Seems like Todd Clifton may have been the victim of a tragic arrangement when Roz was asking, you know, how did they bamboozle you into all of this? And he says, women, is that what it is? And, you know, you fell for these white maggots and all of that. And it seemed like Todd Clifton might have been a victim of a tragic arrangement. More on that to come, perhaps. One of the most important lines in this chapter, I think, when the black man going to tire of this childish perfidy, he got you, so you don't trust your black intelligence. That is so many of us. Gus T, you can put my name at the top of the list. I thought it was important when they're leaving the brawl that they had in the alley, and the protagonist, he's talking to Roz, he's talking to Brother Clifton, and he says, come on, you know, forget Roz. He's full of pus, black pus, anti-blackness, gotta get in. Reminded me of Asada Shakur's book, where she talked about all the insults were made way worse by adding black to anything. Not a bastard, a black bastard. Continuing, the check, that's such a 21st century issue, and talking about predatory lending and check cashing places where predominantly black people live, and to have that in this scene, flashing consistently where checks cashed here is branded across different characters and what have you. It's timeless brilliance of Ralph Ellison. Continuing, Dr. Welsing, she got so many mentions today. Just then a paper bag sailed from a window to my left and burst like a silent grenade, scattering garbage into the trees and pancaking to the earth with a soggy, exhausted plop. I started with disgust, then thought the sun will shine in those backyards someday. A community cleanup campaign might be worthwhile for a slack season. Get an A+ in Room. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she talked about that, how erosion of black self-respect, that's what happens. You throw trash down in an area where you do not value the people yourself. One of the other most important passages in the report. So he starts getting notoriety. I thought it was great the call that mentioned he's a spokesperson. When he's going out and doing all this, and he says, articles, telegrams, and many mailings went out over my signature, some of which I'd written, but most not. Oh, wow. That is the ghostwriting, they call it. Oh, yeah. We'll get Brother Todd or anybody. We'll get this person, black person, get this Negro, put their name on it. And, oh, yeah, they wrote this and they said this and publish it and have it everywhere. And it turns out that's not true at all. And they can just say anything. They are extraordinary at this. That's why very important, that concept of VGQ, to stay out of conflict with other non-white people, because sometimes whites are orchestrating all of this. Very important line, I thought. His commentary about Douglas, Frederick Douglass, towards the end of the chapter, I thought was extremely important, but I'll hush. The last thing I'll get in, if anyone has thoughts on this, I guess if we have any biblical scholars, folks who know your Bible well enough, if you have a thought on the passage or what he means, or even any just appreciation, again, for the absolute literary genius of Ralph Ellison when he's talking about his grandfather again. I think you should pay attention anytime grandfather's name is mentioned. You should be alert. He says, he goes from talking about Douglas and Douglas naming himself, and that's how he got his claim to fame as an orator, use of words. And he says, perhaps the sense of magic lay in the unexpected transformations. You start Saul and end up Paul, my grandfather had often said. When you're a youngin', you Saul, but you let life whoop your head a bit, and you start to trying to be Paul, though you still solve around on the side. Absolute genius of Ralph Ellison. But if anybody has any thoughts on what grandfather meant with that, I would love to hear. If you don't have any thoughts on that, if you just have something else that you want to share, feel free. If you have a line, a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I guess in regards to the Saul Paul biblical reference, I guess this is referring to a character in the Bible who was referenced as Paul. He wrote about 14 books in the Bible, but according to his history, he used to be called a guy named Saul. That was his Greek name, and he used to kill Christians. So he had this conversion to Damascus and changed his name to Paul and became a Christian. I guess what the book is referencing in regards to that is shaving off the old, you know, trying to shave off your old self, but you're still, you're still kind of, still have that old anti-black behavior. And I guess in reference to the story, Christians are kind of like black folks, and, you know, you're still Saul killing, you know, killing Christians or black folks as a metaphor in this particular story. So, I mean, I guess that's what I get out of that. I mean, my life.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I just think that line is, I would think. Yes, sir. I was just going to ask really
I'm
quick.
I'm sorry. I won't let you finish. You can finish. Sorry.
No apologies. No apologies, sir. The caller who just answered with their interpretation, I am not a biblical scholar. I'm a little rusty on all of the different characters and whatnot from the Christian Bible, and I still had a lot of appreciation for that passage. Did that passage stand out to you at all, knowing a little bit more, being more knowledgeable about the Bible? Did that passage stand out to you as of any significance?
Yeah, actually, I did note that when I'm not like reading it, but when it came up, I did kind of note that in regards to that. So when you brought it back up, it reminded me of the whole, you know, the whole Paul's conversion to Christianity.
Got it. Much obliged. The caller who just spoke up, if you had commentary, proceed.
Yeah, I wanted to know what's on page 274 in the book. I wanted to know what is the significance of him stating before he started to describe Brother Clifton. He said that he wore a heavy sweater and slacks, and as the others looked up, I heard a quick intake of a woman's pleasurable sigh. What was the significance of, you know, throwing that in there? I'm a little bit confused.
I think he, just with the description, I think he really wants to emphasize the masculinity, the virility, black masculinity, if you will, of Brother Todd Clifton. And he is a handsome, virile young black male. I think he kind of emphasizes that throughout, even in the fight scene, emphasizing that and to make sure that you get it, that even as he walks in, the white women in the room presumably are swooning as he walks in and puts his broad shoulders down on the dark wooded table. That might be a Welsing moment as well, but that's my interpretation. Anybody else want to answer this question about Todd Clifton and this description when he enters? Go ahead.
I didn't know there were any white women in the room. I thought it was two black women in there. I probably missed that part, but thanks for clearing that up. Thank you.
Might not have been white. It might not have been white. I think I did say presumably on there. Maybe they were not white, but either way, to have females swooning as we are first being introduced to Brother Todd Clifton, we haven't, you know, heard from him before. That's, you know, would still be in line with what my interpretation of why he's described in that manner. I don't think we've had any other character described in that way thus far in the book. Certainly not another male character that I can recall. Did anybody else want to answer that one?
Was it the question about Saul and Paul?
No, about Brother Todd Clifton and why he was described in such a way when he was first introduced.
Yeah. I actually wanted to compliment her point about that. I noticed that as well. And I think he was described that way because in the dominant culture, in this society, in this under this order, there's a fetishization of black bodies, especially black men. Made me think about black male athletes a lot, how their bodies are fetishized and they're kind of compared to Greek gods and the kind of architecture and the way in which whites project themselves into the past. So I thought about that, and I think that gives people a lot of credibility, especially with people like Jim Brown. And, you know, you're just able to see how people are, they resemble a certain sort of whiteness, and then it works as a kind of cultural capital for them. But, yeah, that's what I thought.
I don't appreciate that, Brother Jay. Yeah, he does not say that it was a white woman. He just says the quick intake of a woman's pleasurable sigh. That's all he said. So might not have been a white woman, could have been a black female. And I think if he had already described that everyone present was black, well, then there you go. But either way, females are aghast at his all of this black virility that is in their presence. That's what I think. Anybody else? Any other comments, period? Folks need to get in, or are we ready to get to the second audio segment?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to quickly say that, as I said, it seemed like all the time, this book is just, it's incredible, and I wasn't present for the last study session, but I did listen back to the archives, and as is was also pointed out tonight, and usually is, Joe Morton, you know, his narration is just, you know, incredible, and I like how he did the accent with Roz, and, you know, going back to how this book is just, you know, so well written, just how it's very, as I believe it was Mimi a while ago pointed out, it's very thought-provoking, and The Trash You Give, also known as The Hate You Give, it's just not, and I don't see how anyone could say, just me personally, I don't see how anyone could say that book is well-written, given the, I don't know that anybody did say that, as a matter of fact, but that book just to me was just very poorly written with just all the trash content that was in it. But I had a question for you, Gus, and it's kind of on topic and kind of not, which is, you're not going to leave us, are you, like, doing this yoga training thing? Like, you're going to stay with us, right?
There's nowhere to go. We're still on the plantation, and I'm just trying not to be kicked in yoga class. at any rate, for right now, we are going to leave to do the second audio segment, but we will be right back once that's done, and we will resume the dialogue. That is wacky, retiring to do yoga. That is, anywho, we'll pick it up on chapter 18, right at the beginning. If you have additional comments, questions, if you didn't get to share, just write them down so you don't forget, and we should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Only my Bledsoe trustee-inspired compulsion to read all papers that touched my hands prevented me from throwing the envelope aside. It was unstamped and appeared to be the least important item in the morning's mail. Brother, this is advice from a friend who has been watching you closely. Do not go too fast. Keep working for the people, but remember that you are one of us. And do not forget, if you get too big, they will cut you down. You are from the South, and you know that this is a white man's world. So take a friendly advice and go easy so that you can keep on helping the colored people. They don't want you to go too fast and will cut you down if you do. Be smart. I shot to my feet, the paper rattling poisonously in my hands. What did it mean? Who'd send such a thing? Brother Tarp, I called, reading again the wavery lines of a handwriting that was somehow familiar. Brother Tarp, what is it, son? and looking up, I received another shock. Framed there in the gray, early morning light of the door, my grandfather seemed to look from his eyes. I gave a quick gasp. Then there was a silence in which I could hear his wheezing breath as he eyed me, unperturbed. "What's wrong?" he said, limping into the room. I reached for the envelope. "Where did this come from?" I said.
"What is it?"
he said, taking it calmly from my hands. "It's unstamped."
"Oh, yes, I saw it myself," he said. "I reckon somebody put it in the box late last night. I took it out with the regular mail. Is it something that wasn't for you?"
"No," I said, avoiding his eyes. "But it isn't dated. I was wondering when it arrived. Why are you staring at me?"
"Because it looks to me like you've seen a ghost. You feel sick?"
"It's nothing," I said, just a slight upset. There was an awkward silence. He stood there, and I forced myself to look at his eyes again, finding my grandfather gone, leaving only the searching calm. I said, "Sit down a second, Brother Tarp. Since you're here, I'd like to ask you a question."
"Sure," he said, dropping into the chair. "Go ahead."
"Brother Tarp, you get around and know the members. How do they really feel about me?" He cocked his head.
"Why, sure. They think you're going to make a real leader.
But
ain't no buts. That's what they think. And I don't mind telling you."
"But what about the others?"
"What others?"
"The ones who don't think so much of me."
"Them's the ones I haven't heard about, son."
"I must have some enemies," I said.
"Sure, I guess everybody has them, but I never heard of anybody here in the Brotherhood not liking you. As far as folks up here is concerned, they think you're it."
"You heard any different?" "No, but I was wondering. I've been going along taking them so much for granted that I thought I'd better check so that I can keep their support."
"Well, you don't have to worry. So far, nearly everything you had anything to do with has turned out to be what the folks like, even things some of them resisted. Take that there,"
he said, pointing to the wall near my desk. It was a symbolic poster of a group of heroic figures, an American Indian couple representing the dispossessed past, a blonde brother in overalls, and a leading Irish sister representing the dispossessed present, and Brother Todd Clifton and a young white couple. It had been felt unwise simply to show Clifton and the girl, surrounded by a group of children of mixed races representing the future, a color photograph of bright skin texture and smooth contrast. "So," I said, staring at the legend, "after the struggle, the rainbow of America's future."
"Well, when you first suggested it, some of the members was against you."
"Well, that's certainly true."
"Sure, they raised the devil about the youth members going into the subways and sticking them up in place of them constipation ads and things. But you know what they're doing now?"
"I guess they're holding it against me because some of the kids were arrested," I said.
"Holding it against you? Hell, they're going around bragging about it. But what I was about to say is they're taking them rainbow pictures and tacking them up to their walls along with God Bless Our Home and the Lord's Prayer. They crazy about it. The same way with the hotfooters and all that. You don't have to worry, son. They might resist some of your ideas, but when the deal goes down, they with you right on down to the ground. The only enemies you likely to have is somebody on the outside who's jealous to see you spring up all of a sudden and start doing some of the things what should have been done years ago. And what do you care when some folks start knocking you? It's a sign you're getting someplace."
"I'd like to believe so, Brother Tarp," I said. "As long as I have the people with me, I'll believe in what I'm doing."
"That's right," he said. "When things get rough, it kind of helps to know you got support."
His voice broke off, and he seemed to stare down at me, although he faced me at eye level across the desk. "What is it, Brother Tarp?"
"You from down south, ain't you, son?"
"Yes," I said. He turned in his chair, sliding one hand into his pocket as he rested his chin upon the other.
"I don't really have words to say what just come into my head, son. You see, I was down there for a long time before I come up here. And when I did come up, it was after me. What I mean is, I had to escape. I had to come a-running."
"I guess I did too, in a way," I said.
"You mean they were after you too?"
"Not really, Brother Tarp. I just feel that way."
But this ain't exactly the same thing, he said. You notice this limp I got?
Yes.
Well, I wasn't always lame, and I'm not really now, because the doctors can't find anything wrong with that leg. They say it's sound as a piece of steel. What I mean is, I got this limp from dragging a chain.
I couldn't see it in his face or hear it in his speech, yet I knew he was neither lying nor trying to shock me. I shook my head.
Sure, he said. Nobody knows that about me. They just think I got rheumatism. But it was the chain, and after 19 years, I haven't been able to stop dragging my leg.
19 years?
19 years, 6 months, and 2 days. And what I did wasn't much. That is, it wasn't much when I did it. But after all that time, it changed into something else, and it seemed to be as bad as they said it was. All that time made it bad. I paid for it with everything I had but my life. I lost my wife and my boys and my piece of land. So what started out as an argument between a couple of men turned out to be a crime worth 19 years of my life.
What on earth did you do, Brother Tarm?
I said no to a man who wanted to take something from me. That's what it cost me, for saying no. And even now the debt ain't fully paid and will never be paid in their terms.
A pain throbbed in my throat, and I felt a kind of numb despair. 19 years. And here he was, talking quietly to me, and this, no doubt, the first time he'd try to tell anyone about it. But why me, I thought. Why pick me?
I said no, he said. I said hell no. And I kept saying no until I broke the chain and left. But how? They let me get close to the dogs once in a while. That's how. I made friends with them dogs, and I waited. Down there, you really learn how to wait. I waited 19 years, and then one morning, when the river was flooding, I left. They thought I was one of them who got drowned when the levee broke. But I done broke the chain and gone. I was standing in the mud, holding a long-handled shovel, and I asked myself, Tart, can you make it? And inside me, I said, yes. All that water and mud and rain said, yes, and I took off.
Suddenly he gave a laugh so gay it startled me.
I'm telling it better than I ever thought I could, he said,
fishing in his pocket and removing something that looked like an oilskin tobacco pouch, from which he removed an object wrapped in a handkerchief.
I've been looking for freedom ever since, son, and sometimes I've done all right. Up to these here hard times, I did very well, considering that I'm a man whose health is not too good. But even when times were best for me, I remembered, because I didn't want to forget those 19 years. I just kind of held on to this as a keepsake and a reminder.
He was unwrapping the object now, and I watched his old man's hands.
I'd like to pass it on to you, son.
There, he said, handing it to me.
Funny thing to give somebody, but I think it's got a heap of signifying wrapped up in it, and it might help you remember what we're really fighting against. I don't think of it in terms of but two words, yes and no, but it signifies a heap more.
I saw him place his hand on the desk.
Brother, he said, calling me brother for the first time, I want you to take it. I guess it's a kind of luck piece. Anyway, it's the one I filed to get away.
I took it in my hand, a thick, dark, oily piece of filed steel that had been twisted open and forced partly back into place, on which I saw marks that might have been made by the blade of a hatchet. It was such a link as I had seen on Bledsoe's desk, only while that one had been smooth, Tarp's bore the marks of haste and violence, looking as though it had been attacked and conquered before it stubbornly yielded. I looked at him and shook my head as he watched me inscrutably. Finding no words to ask him more about it, I slipped the link over my knuckles and struck it sharply against the desk. Brother Tarp chuckled.
Well, now there's a way I never thought of using it, he said. It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
But why do you give it to me, Brother Tarp?
Because I have to, I guess. And I don't go trying to get me to say what I can't. You're the talker, not me, he said, getting up and limping toward the door. It was lucky to me, and I think it might be lucky to you. You just keep it with you and look at it once in a while. Of course, if you get tired of it, why, give it back.
Oh, no, I called after him. I want it, and I think I understand. Thanks for giving it to me. I looked at the dark band of metal against my fist and dropped it upon the anonymous letter. I neither wanted it nor knew what to do with it, although there was no question of keeping it if for no other reason than that I felt that Brother Tarp's gesture in offering it was of some deeply felt significance which I was compelled to respect. Something perhaps like a man passing on to his son his own father's watch, which the son accepted not because he wanted the old-fashioned timepiece for itself, but because of the overtones of unstated seriousness and solemnity of the paternal gesture, which had once joined him with his ancestors, marked a high point of his present, and promised a concreteness to the nebulous and chaotic future. And now, I remembered that if I had returned home instead of coming north, my father would have given me my grandfather's old-fashioned Hamilton, with its long, burr-headed winding stem. Well, so my brother would get it, and I'd never wanted it anyway. What were they doing now? I brooded, suddenly sick for home. I could feel the air from the window hot against my neck, as through the smell of morning coffee I heard a throaty voice singing with a mixture of laughter and solemnity. Don't come early in the morning, neither in the heat of the day, but come in the sweet cool of the evening and wash my sins away. A whole series of memories started to well up, but I threw them off. There was no time for memory, for all its images were of times past. There had only been a few minutes from the time that I'd called in Brother Tarp about the letter and his leaving, but it seemed as though I'd plunged down a well of years. I looked calmly now at the writing, which, for a moment, had shaken my total structure of certainty, and was glad that Brother Tarp had been there to be called rather than Clifton or some of the others before whom I would have been ashamed of my panic. Instead, he'd left me soberly confident, perhaps from the shock of seeming to see my grandfather looking through Tarp's eyes, perhaps through the calmness of his voice alone, or perhaps through his story and his link of chain, he had restored my perspective. He's right, I thought. Whoever sent the message is trying to confuse me. Some enemy is trying to halt our progress by destroying my faith through touching upon my old southern distrust, our fear of white betrayal. It was as though he had learned of my experience with Bledsoe's letters and was trying to use that knowledge to destroy not only me, but the whole Brotherhood. Yet that was impossible. No one knew that story who knew me now. It was simply an obscene coincidence. If only I could get my hands upon his stupid throat. Here in the Brotherhood was the one place in the country where we were free and given the greatest encouragement to use our abilities, and he was trying to destroy it. No, it wasn't me he was worrying about becoming too big. It was the Brotherhood. And becoming big was exactly what the Brotherhood wanted. Hadn't I just received orders to submit ideas for organizing more people? And a white man's world was just what the Brotherhood was against. We were dedicated to building a world of brotherhood. But who had sent it? Ross the Exhorter? No, it wasn't like him. He was more direct and absolutely against any collaboration between blacks and whites. It was someone else, someone more insidious than Ross. But who, I wondered, forcing it below my consciousness as I turned to the tasks at hand. The morning began with people asking my advice on how to secure relief, members coming in for instructions for small committee meetings being held in corners of the large hall. And I had just dismissed a woman seeking to free her husband who had been jailed for beating her when Brother Restrum entered the room. I returned his greeting and watched him ease into a chair, his eyes sweeping over my desk with uneasiness. He seemed to possess some kind of authority in the Brotherhood, but his exact function was unclear. He was, I felt, something of a meddler. And hardly had he settled himself when he stared at my desk, saying, "What you got there, brother?" and pointed toward a pile of my papers. I leaned slowly back in my chair, looking him in the eye. "That's my work," I said coldly, determined to stop any interference from the start. "But I mean that," he said, pointing, his eyes beginning to blaze. "That there." "It's work," I said, "all my work." "Is that too?" he said, pointing to Brother Tarp's leg link. Oh, that's just a personal present, brother, I said. What could I do for you? That ain't what I asked you, brother. What is it? I picked up the link and held it toward him, the metal oily and strangely skin-like now, with the slanting sun entering the window. Would you care to examine it, brother? One of our members wore it 19 years on the chain gang. Hell no, he recoiled. I mean, no thank you. In fact, brother, I don't think we ought to have such things around. You think so? I said. And just why? Because I don't think we ought to dramatize our differences. I'm not dramatizing anything. It's my personal property that happens to be lying on my desk. But people can see it. That's true, I said, but I think it's a good reminder of what our movement is fighting against. No, sir, he said, shaking his head. No, sir. That's the worst kind of thing for the Brotherhood, because we want to make folks think of the things we have in common. That's what makes for Brotherhood. We have to change this way we have of always talking about how different we are. In the Brotherhood, we are all brothers. I was amused. He was obviously disturbed by something deeper than a need to forget differences. Fear was in his eyes. I never thought of it just that way, brother, I said, dangling the iron between my finger and thumb. But you want to think about it, he said. We have to discipline ourselves. Things that don't make for brotherhood have to be rooted out. We have enemies, you know. I watch everything I do and say so as to be sure that I don't upset the brotherhood, because this is a wonderful movement, brother, and we have to keep it that way. We have to watch ourselves, brother. You know what I mean? Too often we are liable to forget that this is something that's a privilege to belong to. We're liable to say things that don't do nothing but make for more misunderstanding. What's driving him, I thought. What's all this to do with me? Could he have sent me the note? Dropping the iron, I fished for the anonymous note from beneath the pile and held it by a corner so that the slanting sun shone through the page and outlined the scrawling letters. I watched him intently. He was leaning upon the desk now, looking at the page, but with no recognition in his eyes. I dropped the page upon the chain, more disappointed than relieved. "Between you and me, brother," he said, "there are those amongst us who don't really believe in the Brotherhood." "Oh? You damn right they don't. They're just in it to use it for their own ends. Some call you brother to your face, and the minute you turn your back, you're a black son of a bitch. You got to watch 'em." "I haven't encountered any of that, brother," I said. "You will. There's lots of poison around. Some don't want to shake your hand, and some don't like the idea of seeing too much of you. But goddammit, in a brotherhood, they got to." I looked at him. It had never occurred to me that the Brotherhood could force anyone to shake my hand, and that he found satisfaction that it could was both shocking and distasteful. Suddenly, he laughed. "Yes, goddammit, they gotta. Me, I don't let them get away with nothing. If they're gonna be brothers, let them be brothers. Oh, but I'm fair," he said, his face suddenly self-righteous. "I'm fair. I ask myself every day, what are you doing against brotherhood? And when I find it, I root it out. I burn it like a man cauterizing a mad dog bite. This business of being a brother is a full-time job. You have to be pure in heart, and you have to be disciplined in body and mind. Brother, you understand what I mean?" "Yes, I think I do," I said. "Some folks feel that way about their religion." "Religion?" He blinked his eyes. "Folks like me and you is full of distrust," he said. "We've been corrupted till it's hard for some of us to believe in brotherhood. And some even want revenge. That's what I'm talking about. We have to root it out. We have to learn to trust our other brothers. After all, didn't they start the brotherhood? Didn't they come and stretch out their hand to us black men and say, 'We want y'all for our brothers'? Didn't they do it? Didn't they now? Didn't they set out to organize us and help fight our battle and all like that? Sure they did. And we have to remember it 24 hours a day. Brotherhood. That's the word we got to keep right in front of our eyes every second. Now, this brings me to why I come to see you, brother." He sat back, his huge hands grasping his knees. "I got a plan I want to talk over with you." "Well, what is it, brother?" I said. "Well, it's like this. I think we ought to have some way of showing what we are. We ought to have some banners and things like that. Especially for us black brothers." "I see," I said, becoming interested. "But why do you think this is important?"
"'Cause it helps the brotherhood, that's why. First, if you remember,
When you watch our people, when there's a parade or funeral or a dance or anything like that, they always have some kind of flags and banners, even if they don't mean anything. It kind of makes the occasion seem more important-like. It makes people stop, look, and listen. What's coming off here? But you know and I know that they ain't none of them got no true flag, except maybe Ross the Exhorter, and he claims he's Ethiopian or African. But none of us got no true flag, because that flag don't really belong to us. They want a true flag, one that's as much theirs as anybody else's. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think I do, I said, remembering that there was always that sense in me of being apart when the flag went by. It had been a reminder until I'd found the Brotherhood that my star was not yet there.
Sure you know, Brother Restrom said. Everybody wants a flag. We need a flag that stands for brotherhood, and we need a sign we can wear.
A sign? You know, a pin or a button.
You mean an emblem? That's it. Something we can wear, a pin or something like that, so that when a brother meets a brother, they can know it. That way that thing what happened to Brother Todd Clifton wouldn't have happened.
What wouldn't have happened? He sat back.
Don't you know about it?
I don't know what you mean.
It's something that's best forgot about, he said,
leaning close, his big hands gripped and stretched before him.
But you see, there was a rally, and some hoodlums tried to break up the meeting. And in the fighting, Brother Todd Clifton got hold to one of the white brothers by mistake and was beating him. Thought he was one of the hoodlums, he said. Things like that is bad, brother. Very bad. But with some of these emblems, things like that wouldn't happen.
So that actually happened, I said.
Sure did. That Brother Clifton goes wild when he gets mad. But what do you think of my idea?
I think it should be brought to the attention of the committee, I said guardedly as the phone rang. Excuse me for a moment, brother, I said. It was the editor of a new picture magazine requesting an interview of
one of our most successful young men.
That's very flattering, I said, but I'm afraid I'm too busy for an interview. I suggest, however, that you interview our youth leader, Brother Todd Clifton. You'll find him a much more interesting subject.
No, no, Restrom said, shaking his head violently as the editor said.
But we want you. You've...
And you know, I interrupted, our work is considered very controversial, certainly by some.
But that's exactly why we want you. You've become identified with that controversy, and it's our job to bring such subjects to the eyes of our readers.
But so is Brother Clifton, I said.
No, sir. You're the man, and you owe it to our youth to allow us to tell them your story, he said as I watched Brother Restrom leaning forward. We feel that they should be encouraged to keep fighting towards success. After all, you are one of the latest to fight his way to the top. We need all the heroes we can get.
But please, I laughed over the phone, I'm no hero, and I'm far from the top. I'm a cog in a machine. We here in the Brotherhood work as a unit, I said, seeing Brother Restrom nod his head in agreement.
But you can't get around the fact that you're the first of our people to attract attention to it, can you now?
Brother Clifton was active at least 3 years before me. Besides, it isn't that simple. Individuals don't count for very much. It's what the group wants, what the group does. Everyone here submerges his personal ambitions for the common achievement.
Good, that's very good. People want to hear that. All people need to have someone say that to them. Why don't you let me send out an interviewer? I'll have her there in 20 minutes.
You're very insistent, but I'm very busy, I said. And if Brother Restrom hadn't been wig-wagging trying to tell me what to say, I would have refused. Instead, I consented. Perhaps, I thought, a little friendly publicity wouldn't hurt. Such a magazine would reach many timid souls living far from the sound of our voices. I had only to remember to say little about my past. I'm sorry for this interruption, brother, I said, putting down the phone and looking into his curious eyes. I'll bring your idea to the attention of the committee as quickly as possible. I stood to discourage further talk, and he got up, fairly bursting to continue.
Well, I've got to see some other brothers myself, he said. I'll be seeing you soon.
Anytime, I said, avoiding his hand by picking up some papers. Going out, he turned with his hand on the doorframe, frowning.
And brother, don't forget what I said about that thing you got on your desk. Things like that don't do nothing but cause confusion. They ought to be kept out of sight.
I was glad to see him go.
The idea of his trying to tell me what to say in a conversation, only part of which he could have heard. And it was obvious that he disliked Clifton. Well, I disliked him, and all that foolishness and fear over the leg chain. Tarp had worn it for 19 years and could laugh, but this big... Then I forgot Brother Restrom until about 2 weeks later at our downtown headquarters, where a meeting had been called to discuss strategy. Everyone had arrived before me. Long benches were arranged at one side of the room, which was hot and filled with smoke. Usually such meetings sounded like a prize fight or a smoker, but now everyone was silent. The White brothers looked uncomfortable and some of the Harlan brothers belligerent. Nor did they leave me time to think about it. No sooner had I apologized for my lateness than Brother Jack struck the table with his gavel, addressing his first remarks to me.
Brother, there seems to be a serious misunderstanding among some of the brothers concerning your work and recent conduct, he said.
I stared at him blankly, my mind groping for connections. I'm sorry, Brother Jack, I said, but I don't understand. You mean there's something wrong with my work?
So it seems, he said, his face completely neutral.
Certain charges have been made. Charges? Have I failed to carry out some directive?
About that, there seems to be some doubt, but we'd better let Brother Restrom speak of this, he said.
Brother Restrom? I was shocked. He hadn't been around since our talk, and I looked across the table into his evasive face, seeing him stand with a slouch, a rolled paper protruding from his pocket.
Yes, brothers, he said. I brought charges, much as I hated to have to do it. But I've been watching the way things have been going, and I decided that if they don't stop soon, this brother is going to make a fool out of the Brotherhood.
There were some sounds of protest.
Yes, I said it, and I mean it. This here brother constitutes one of the greatest dangers ever confronted by our movement.
I looked at Brother Jack. His eyes were sparkling. I seemed to see traces of a smile as he scribbled something on a pad. I was becoming very hot.
Be more specific, brother, Brother Garnett, a White brother, said. These are serious charges, and we all know that the brother's work has been splendid. Be specific.
Sure, I'll be specific, Restrom boomed, suddenly whipping the paper from his pocket, unrolling it, and throwing it on the table. This here's what I mean.
I took a step forward. It was a portrait of me, looking out from a magazine page. Where did that come from? I said.
That's it, he boomed. Make out like you never seen it.
But I haven't, I said. I really haven't.
Don't lie to these White brothers. Don't lie.
I'm not lying. I never saw it before in my life. But suppose I had. What's wrong with it?
You know what's wrong, Restrom said.
Look, I don't know anything. What's on your mind? You have us all here, so if you have anything to say, please, get it over with.
Brothers, this is a opportunist. All you got to do is read this article to see. I charge this man with using the Brotherhood movement to advance his own selfish interests.
Article? Then I remembered the interview, which I had forgotten. I met the eyes of the others as they looked from me to Restrom.
And what does it say about us? Brother Jack said, pointing to the magazine.
Say, Restrom said. Doesn't say anything. It's all about him. What he thinks, what he does, what he's going to do. Not a word about the rest of us who's been building the movement before he was ever heard of. Look at it. If you think I'm lying, look at it.
Brother Jack turned to me. Is this true? I haven't read it, I said. I had forgotten that I was interviewed.
But you remember it now, Brother Jack said.
Yes, I do now, and he happened to be in the office when the appointment was made. They were silent.
Hell, Brother Jack, Restrom said, is right here in black and white. He's trying to give people the idea that he's the whole Brotherhood movement.
I'm doing nothing of the sort. I tried to get the editor to interview Brother Todd Clifton. You know that. Since you know so little about what I'm doing, why not tell the brothers what you're up to?
I'm exposing a double dealer. That's what I'm doing. I'm exposing you. Brothers, this man is a pure D opportunist.
All right, I said. Expose me if you can, but stop the slander.
I'll expose you all right, he said, sticking out his chin. I'm going to. He's doing everything I said, brothers. And I'll tell you something else. He's trying to sew things up so that the members won't move unless he tells them to. Look at a few weeks ago when he was off in Philly. We tried to get a rally going, and what happens? Only about 200 people turned out. He's trying to train them so they won't listen to no one but him. But, brother, didn't we decide that the appeal had been improperly phrased? A brother interrupted. Yeah, I know, but that wasn't it. But the committee analyzed the appeal, and I know, brothers, and I don't aim to dispute the committee. But, brothers, it just seems that way because you don't know this man. He works in the dark. He's got some kind of plot. What kind of plot? One of the brothers said, leaning across the table. Just a plot, Restrom said. He aims to control the movement uptown. He wants to be a dictator. The room was silent, except for the humming of the fans. They looked at him with a new concern. These are very serious charges, brother, two brothers said in unison. Serious? I know they're serious. That's how come I brought them. This opportunist thinks that because he's got a little more education, he's better than anybody else. He's what Brother Jack calls a petty individualist. He struck the conference table with his fists, his eyes showing small and round in his taut face. I wanted to punch that face. It no longer seemed real, but a mask behind which the real face was probably laughing, both at me and at the others. For he couldn't believe what he had said. It just wasn't possible. He was the plotter, and from the serious looks on the committee's faces, he was getting away with it. Now several brothers started to speak at once, and Brother Jack knocked for order. Brothers, please, Brother Jack said. One at a time. What do you know about this article? He said to me. Not very much, I said. The editor of the magazine called to say he was sending a reporter up for an interview. The reporter asked a few questions and took a few pictures with a little camera. That's all I know. Did you give the reporter a prepared handout? I gave her nothing except a few pieces of our official literature. I told her neither what to ask me nor what to write. I naturally tried to cooperate. If an article about me would help make friends for the movement, I felt it was my duty. Brothers, this thing was arranged, Restrom said. I tell you, this opportunist had that reporter sent up there. He had her sent up, and he told her what to write. That's a contemptible lie, I said. You know I tried to get them to interview Brother Clifton. Who's a lie? You're a liar and a fat-mouthed scoundrel. You're a liar and no brother of mine. Now he's calling me names. Brothers, you heard him. Let's not lose our tempers, Brother Jack said calmly. Brother Restrom, you've made serious charges. Can you prove them? I can prove them. All you have to do is read the magazine and prove them for yourself. It will be read. And what else? All you have to do is listen to the folks in Harlem. All they talk about is him. Never nothing about what the rest of us do. I tell you, brothers, this man constitutes a danger to the people of Harlem. He ought to be thrown out. That is for the committee to decide, Brother Jack said. Then to me, and what have you to say in your defense, brother? In my defense, I said, nothing. I haven't anything to defend. I've tried to do my work, and if the brothers don't know that, then it's too late to tell them. I don't know what's behind this, but I haven't gotten around to controlling magazine writers, and I didn't realize that I was coming to stand trial either. This is not intended as a trial, Brother Jack said. If you're ever put on trial, and I hope you'll never be, you'll know it. Meantime, since this is an emergency, the committee asks that you leave the room while we read and discuss the questioned interview. I left the room and went into a vacant office, boiling with anger and disgust. Restrom had snatched me back to the South in the midst of one of the top Brotherhood committees, and I felt naked. I could have throttled him, forcing me to take part in a childish dispute before the others. Yet I had to fight him as I could in terms he understood, even though we sounded like characters in a razor-slinging vaudeville skit. Perhaps I should mention the anonymous note, except that someone might take it to mean that I didn't have the full support of my district. If Clifton were here, he'd know how to handle this clown. Were they taking him seriously just because he was black?
What was wrong with them anyway? Couldn't they see that they were dealing with a clown? But I would have gone to pieces had they laughed or even smiled, I thought. For they couldn't laugh at him without laughing at me as well. Yet if they had laughed, it would have been less unreal. Where the hell am I?
You can come in now,
a brother called to me. And I went out to hear the decision.
Well, Brother Jack said, we've read the article, brother, and we're happy to report that we found it harmless enough. True, it would have been better had more wordage been given to other members of the Harlem District, but we found no evidence that you had anything to do with that. Brother Restrum was mistaken. His bland manner and the knowledge that they had wasted time to see the truth released the anger within me.
I'd say that he was criminally mistaken, I said.
Not criminal, overzealous, he said.
To me it seems both criminal and overzealous, I said.
No, brother, not criminal.
But he attacked my reputation.
Brother Jack smiled, only because he was sincere, brother. He was thinking of the good of the Brotherhood.
But why slander me? I don't follow you, Brother Jack. I'm no enemy, as he well knows. I'm a brother, too, I said, seeing his smile.
The Brotherhood has many enemies, and we must not be too harsh with brotherly mistakes.
Then I saw the foolish, abashed expression on Restrum's face and relaxed.
Very well, Brother Jack, I said. I suppose I should be glad you found me innocent. Concerning the magazine article, he said, stabbing the air with his finger. Something tensed in the back of my head. I got to my feet.
Concerning the article? You mean to say that you believe that other pipe dream? Is everyone reading Dick Tracy these days?
This is no matter of Dick Tracy, he snapped. The movement has many enemies.
So now I have become an enemy, I said. What's happened to everybody? You act as though none of you has any contact with me at all.
Jack looked at the table. Are you interested in our decision, brother?
Oh, yes, I said. Yes, I am. I'm interested in all manner of odd behavior. Who wouldn't be? When one wild man can make a room full of what I'd come to regard as some of the best minds in the country take him seriously. Certainly I'm interested. Otherwise, I'd act like a sensible man and run out of here.
There were sounds of protest, and Brother Jack, his face red, rapped for order.
Perhaps I should address a few words to the brother, Brother McAfee said.
Go ahead, Brother Jack said thickly.
Brother, we understand how you feel, Brother McAfee said. But you must understand that the movement has many enemies. This is very true, and we are forced to think of the organization at the expense of our personal feelings. The Brotherhood is bigger than all of us. None of us as individuals count when its safety is questioned. And be assured that none of us have anything but goodwill toward you personally. Your work has been splendid. This is simply a matter of the safety of the organization, and it is our responsibility to make a thorough investigation of all such charges.
I felt suddenly empty. There was a logic in what he said, which I felt compelled to accept. They were wrong, but they had the obligation to discover their mistake. Let them go ahead. They'd find that none of the charges were true, and I'd be vindicated. What was all this obsession with enemies, anyway? I looked into their smoke-washed faces. Not since the beginning had I faced such serious doubts.
Up to now, I had felt a wholeness about my work and direction, such as I'd never known, not even in my mistaken college days. Brotherhood was something to which men could give themselves completely. That was its strength and my strength. And it was this sense of wholeness that guaranteed that it would change the course of history. This I had believed with all my being, but now, though still inwardly affirming that belief, I felt a blighting hurt which prevented me from trying further to defend myself. I stood there silently, waiting their decision. Someone drummed his fingers against the table. I heard the dry leaf rustle of onion-skin papers.
Be assured that you can depend upon the fairness and wisdom of the committee, Brother Tobit's voice drifted from the end of the table. But there was smoke between us, and I could barely see his face.
The committee has decided, Brother Jack began crisply, that until all charges have been cleared, you are to have the choice of becoming inactive in Harlem or accepting an assignment downtown. In the latter case, you are to wind up your present assignment immediately. I felt weak in my legs.
You mean I am to give up my work?
Unless you choose to serve the movement elsewhere.
But can't you see,
I said, looking from face to face and seeing the blank finality in their eyes. Your assignment, should you decide to remain active, Brother Jack said, reaching for his gavel, is to lecture downtown on the woman question. Suddenly I felt as though I had been spun like a top.
The what?
The woman question. My pamphlet on the woman question in the United States will be your guide. And now, brothers, he said, his eyes sweeping around the table, the meeting is adjourned. I stood there, hearing the rapping of his gavel echoing in my ears, thinking, the woman question, and searching their faces for signs of amusement, listening to their voices for the slightest sound of suppressed laughter, stood there fighting the sense that I had just been made the butt of an outrageous joke, and all the more so since their faces revealed no awareness. My mind fought desperately for acceptance. Nothing would change matters. They would shift me and investigate, and I, still believing, still bending to discipline, would have to accept their decision. Now was certainly no time for inactivity. Not just when I was beginning to approach some aspects of the organization about which I knew nothing, of higher committees and the leaders who never appeared, of the sympathizers and allies in groups that seemed far removed from our concerns, not at a time when all the secrets of power and authority still shrouded from me in mystery appeared on the way toward revelation. No. Despite my anger and disgust, my ambitions were too great to surrender so easily. Why should I restrict myself? Segregate myself? I was a spokesman. Why shouldn't I speak about women, or on any other subject? Nothing lay outside the scheme of our ideology. There was a policy on everything, and my main concern was to work my way ahead in the movement. I left the building still feeling as though I had been violently spun, but with optimism growing. Being removed from Harlem was a shock, but one which would hurt them as much as me, for I had learned that the clue to what Harlem wanted was what I wanted, and my value to the Brotherhood was no different from the value to me of my most useful contact. It depended upon my complete frankness and honesty in stating the community's hopes and hates, fears and desires. One spoke to the committee as well as to the community. No doubt it would work much the same downtown. The new assignment was a challenge and an opportunity for testing how much of what happened in Harlem was due to my own efforts and how much to the sheer eagerness of the people themselves. And after all, I told myself, the assignment was also proof of the committee's goodwill, for by selecting me to speak with its authority on a subject which elsewhere in our society I'd have found taboo, weren't they affirming their belief both in me and in the principles of brotherhood, proving that they drew no lines even when it came to women? They had to investigate the charges against me, but the assignment was their unsentimental affirmation that their belief in me was unbroken. I shivered in the hot street. I hadn't allowed the idea to take concrete form in my mind, but for a moment, I had almost allowed an old southern backwardness, which I had thought dead, to wreck my career. Leaving Harlem was not without its regrets, however, and I couldn't bring myself to say goodbye to anyone, not even to Brother Tarp or Clifton, not to mention the others upon whom I depended for information concerning the lowest groups in the community. I simply slipped my papers into my briefcase and left as though going downtown for a meeting.
Context of White Supremacy. That's where we will pick up at next week, Chapter 19, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed. Wow, folks are lollygagging with their hands. We only have 30 minutes, or a little less than 30, actually, in the broadcast. So if you do not think you have a question, comment, or what have you, please don't wait till the last 5 minutes and decide, oh, wait, there are about 30 things that stood out in the text that I would like to share. I will make sure that I get in some of the comments or notes that I took for chapter 18. We also had people who wrote in as well who've been following the archives. So chapter 18, some of the things that I noted. Grandfather gets referenced immediately at the beginning of chapter 18 when he comes in after he gets this wacky note. Framed there in the gray early morning light of the door, my grandfather seemed to look from his eyes. Any of those references to granddad, I think folks should certainly pay attention to, think about. The whole note that he gets at the beginning, great bit of foreshadowing, I think, frequently throughout the portion of the book that we've read to this point. The protagonist is kind of naive about things. He has a lot of optimism, regardless of what situation he's going into, that he's going to be able to work hard and things will work out well for him. And once again, him getting some sort of hint that, yeah, this is probably not going to work well, especially if you're relying on the brotherhood from these whites. Next. Let's see. The whole conversation with Brother Tarp about the leg iron, I think I'd said... I don't know if it was last week or the week before, but I said there are going to be lots of these types of trinkets that are going to be accumulated by the time we get to the end of the book. Dr. Bledsoe leg iron. Now we've got another leg iron, the Jolly Nigger Bank, some of the items that were thrown out in the eviction from the elderly couple. That was, I guess, maybe 2-3 weeks ago. These little trinkets, and especially the trinkets that get saved, the leg iron, the Jolly Nigger Bank, more of these to come. Pay attention. What do we think about, you know, the symbol, the symbolism of these items? What do they represent? Think about that as we continue. Let's see. I thought the ad when he's talking to Brother Tarp and they're talking about some of his ideas that he's had, and maybe the group did, the Brotherhood didn't like them at first, and then they changed their mind and they ended up liking them. And he talks about this poster, and he says, a poster of an American Indian couple representing the dispossessed past, a blonde brother in overalls. Just hearing that sounded so strange to me, a blonde brother. And a leading Irish sister representing the dispossessed present, and Brother Todd Clifton and a young white couple. It had been felt unwise simply to show Clifton and the girl, cowbell, surrounded by a group of children of mixed races representing the future, a color photograph of bright skin texture and smooth contrast. That, again, I think Ross, the exhorter, had just said, questioned whether or not Brother Todd Clifton, a white woman, he had been tragically touched. I thought the hot footers, I meant to say something about this last time around. There is a lot of referencing of Marcus Garvey and the United Negro Improvement Association and the parades that they would have in New York. I think there's a lot of referencing. Again, this book was published in 1952, but this period that he's talking about is set in the 1920s. So right a little bit after Garvey's fame and prominence before COINTELPRO. Black identity extremist. That was the 100 years ago version. Let's see. I thought it was fascinating when Brother Tarp is talking about refusing a white or, yeah, saying no. I think it was a white person, but him saying no and how he ended up in prison for 19 years and how everyone thinks that he's lame. And that's not the case, that the doctors can't find anything wrong with his leg. I thought that was fascinating. It reminded me of E. Franklin Frazier, who wrote Black Bourgeoisie. He wrote many things. The Negro Church in America. He wrote a lot of books. Incredible scholar. Minister Malcolm X referenced him a lot. He also wrote an article. He was a sociologist. He was doing research and he noted that there was a phenomenon in the South where many black males specifically, they had a habit of saying, when you would ask, you know, how are you doing? Their response would be, wait for it, right poorly. Put that in quotes. And so they would investigate to be like, well, why are you all saying right poor? What's, you know, what's wrong with you? Are you feeling bad? Is something aching? And nothing would be wrong with them, but they would just be in a habit of saying right poorly. And he investigated to see why. His conclusion was that system of white supremacy, they were doing right poorly, even if they didn't have a physical ailment. So that the terrorism and stress that they were experiencing was being verbally articulated by them phrasing right poorly. That's what that phrase reminded me, though, him being lame, even though there's nothing physically wrong with his leg. Fascinating. Let's see. The conversation. Let's see. So this is Brother, I'm messing up his name. Brother, when he gets a Rushstrom, it's that odd, bizarre name. When he comes in and gets accused, or before he gets accused, when he comes in and they're having their conversation about the leg iron that he does not like. This, he sounded very similar to the protagonist, even though I don't remember the protagonist going around and challenging another black person in this way. That white identification, the way that the protagonist is being attacked, like this leg iron somehow is trying to make it about black people, and this is our great organization that we have here, and you know, you're kind of mess things up, and I'm going to snitch on you. I'm going to rat him out. We got this no count black person coming in here and getting all this attention, and I'm going to rat him out, get him out of here. He's messing it all up. He's going to mess things up with the good white people. I think the main character has a lot of those same types of attitudes. To me, it doesn't strike me as being odd that this sort of conflict would happen in this organization. And the whites, they get to be the ones to adjudicate. They get to sit back and judge the conflict, and we'll make the ultimate decision about what's going to happen with this conflict. The last thing that I'll say for right now, I took a few other notes, but the last thing that I'll get in right now, the portion a little bit later in chapter 18, they're talking about, I guess this was a time that happened before, Brother Rushstrom is talking with the protagonist, and they're talking about the previous rally where, and his idea that they should be banners of some sorts so that everybody who's in the Brotherhood can be recognized. He says they were at a rally of some sort, and some whites were there taunting them, and Brother Todd got upset, and he went to go swing, and he says, Brother Todd got hold to one of the white brothers, my mistake, and was beating him. Thought he was one of the hoodlums, he said. Things like that is bad, brother, very bad. I thought that was an extremely important paragraph. Number one, because of the highlighted section from chapter 17 about you have to plunge out of history, and it was, you have to plunge out of history, and you might end up killing someone. Make sure I get the, it was violence. Make sure I give the correct quote, plunge outside, turn his back, otherwise he might kill somebody, go nuts. That was Brother Todd in chapter 17. And then in chapter 18, we hear Brother Todd Clifton got hold to one of the white brothers by mistake and was beating him. Thought he was one of the hoodlums, he said, and he has he in italics, as though there might be some suspicion that, you know, maybe he might have just went crazy and wanted to grab any white person will do, as Minister Malcolm said. I thought that was a hugely important point. And again, I go back to what I've been saying from the very beginning, or for weeks now, Ralph Ellison, the rage that he has against whites, I think it comes out every page, paragraphs like this, all throughout the text. You have instances of black people talking about being violently angry with white people, acting out on it. So many instances of those of that throughout the text, and more to come. Todd Clifton. Any other folks have comments that they want to make sure that they get in? I think Rob in Wisconsin, you should be with us.
Can I be heard, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let me put my headset in quickly here. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings to Gus, the host, and the listeners and the callers on the line. I missed the second audio, but I did read chapter 17 today, and I got to listen to the first audio section. And guess how you say the brilliance of Ralph Ellison, chapter 17, the confrontation with Roz the Exhorter. I thought that everything is comes down to perception and or how we interpret things. And for me, the speech from Roz lays out the standard I think black people should live up to and or try to live up to. But the system of white supremacy is such a great opponent. I thought that the how the confrontation ended really spoke to how the system, I won't say can't be beat, but is unbeaten at this point. And I thought that Ralph Ellison also in that speech from Roz kind of bared his soul. And thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Roz has many powerful moments in the book. More to come. Extraordinarily important character. Self-respect. I mean, had some Dr. Welsing leaping off the page there in chapter 17. Folks, brother, thank you, Brother Rob in Wisconsin. Brother Demery Four, did you have commentary?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I thought that in the beginning, the inconspicuous piece of mail that the narrator received was probably the first sign that the narrator had that his involvement with the Brotherhood may not be what it seemed to be. And his conversation with Brother Tark, you know, I thought it was interesting that Brother Tark, he saw his grandfather through Brother Tark's eyes, something about him. And then Brother Tark, being a victim himself of some cruel injustice, because he had just said no to a man that wanted something from him. That sounds like an encounter with a white person. And he ended up losing his wife, his family, his freedom, and was chained and shackled, which leaves him with a limp. And then he gives the chain and the shackle to the narrator and tells him it's good luck piece. I thought that was, it's almost like carrying a rabbit's foot around with you. It wasn't lucky to the rabbit, but you carrying it as good luck piece. And Brother Tark versus Brother Winthrop. Brother Tark says that the narrator was a token, not him. And he asked him if he was from the South, you know, and I noticed that in the book, they make reference to the South and the North. I guess they had a feeling that the South was more racist than the North, and or that if you were black and from the South, you should know
You should understand things better than someone who is in the North. And I don't think geographic position matters, you know, when you're mistreated, whether it's the North or the South. It may be a different brand of racism, or it may be more refined in the North, but it exists, you know, not only the North, South, this part of the planet, but globally. Yeah, the black guy, Brother Winthrop, that was offended, you know, by the piece, and then later turned the narrator, you know, brought him before the white people, you know, to accuse him of something. You know, that plays out even nowadays. You know, you have some person that thinks that he has some position, or that he knows what reality is dealing with these white people, and that you are going to create a problem with maybe his existence, so that he want to get you out of the picture so that he can maintain his little position with the white people. And I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Brother Demery. For any other folks have comments they want to make sure they get in before we wrap up, please do not do the waiting. Sister Red in Nevada, making sure I got both brother and sister in. Sister Red in Nevada, did you have commentary?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. Hello, brothers and sisters. Just a couple of things I'm only going to share on this chapter. I also have commentary about Brother Tart and just how it was described, how he was speaking quietly about having 19 years of his, basically of his life being taken. And it reminded me of how victims of white supremacy who are released out of prison like in contemporary time, how they have this calmness, you know, like picking cotton, stuff like that, where they are, you know, wrongfully convicted and have decades and taken and family, and they're really calm, not really displaying that anger, which would seem like it would be normal as a human being. The other thing later, not that long after that part, when actually Brother Tarp was talking about his escape, and he mentioned how the levees had broke. And I thought that was really interesting how to incorporate, I guess, like maybe like the 1849 levees breaking in Louisiana. That's what it at least made me think about with that part. And the last thing I'll say is I thought it was interesting during the whole argument, or there's actually two things, our whole argument between the protagonist, and I think it's kind of like his black antagonist, Brother Restroom, and like his name reminds me of a restroom, a bathroom, you know, something to be used by people, and you know, like a stinky place. And I think that's kind of interesting. That's what kind of makes me feel like maybe it might be like kind of somewhat of his antagonist. So it would be that name, I guess, would kind of be fitting. But how at least where I counted three times within this chapter where Brother Jack is smiling as these two black males are kind of fighting over, you know, being in this group or having currying a favor from this group. Brother Jack, it said Brother Jack had wrote down, says, I looked at Brother Jack's eyes. I looked at Brother Jack. His eyes were sparkling. I seemed to see traces of a smile as he scribbled something on a pad. And then again, another couple of times where they're, you know, kind of talking about the whole situation, the accusation, and Brother Jack is smiling. And I think that's kind of, at least to me, saying, you know, this is what, you know, suspected white supremacists want. They want us to fight over each other over this, you know, imagined position that they can take away at any moment. Now I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Great point. Great point about Brother Jack enjoying, smiling, contentment with all of this. Do we have anybody else who had commentary they wanted to get in before we conclude chapter 18? We just concluded. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man.
Not heard.
Sister Ivy.
Brother Renegade, and I got your back, even though I don't got my own back. I wanted to ask you, what was the reason that, and maybe I can go back and listen to it, but I hope you can answer, the reason that it seemed like the protagonist got, like, kicked out of the group for a momentary time, like, they already cleared him of, you know, the magazine issue. So what was the reason ultimately that he got kicked out, and somebody got to go talk about women or something?
Let's see. They cleared him on. Oh, see there. Okay. Let's make sure we get the exact other charges. Enemy. Let's see. Wow. Buckets and buckets of words to get to exactly what the charge is going to be. Safety of the organization. Okay. Until all charges have been cleared. I'm even seeing another choice. Go ahead, Mr. Demery Four.
No, I was going to say, I think the charges were that the narrator was trying to promote himself using the Brotherhood's, using them for self-promotion.
Right. Did they say that specifically? Or are they? Is that just you're going from what Brother Rushstrom, and thank you for the analysis of the name. Are you just going on what Brother Rushstrom, because that was his accusation. Do you remember a passage where Brother Jack or someone from the Brotherhood says that that's the reason that you are going to be addressing the woman's question and no longer in Harlem?
Oh, no. No, I don't know why that. I just looked at it similar to when something comes up with white people, they get transferred. So in that situation, he got transferred rather than let go. He didn't. They didn't kick him out of the Brotherhood. He just got transferred.
Right. Yeah, I've been looking. I'm going to reread, but for, unless I missed it or unless somebody else saw it, they didn't say, okay, we cleared you on the magazine question, but we are going to check to see if you, you know, are doing some self-promotion or violating another bylaw. Like, they were not specific. They just said, until we get to investigate the other charges, then you're going to be working on the Women's Committee unless you are going to be no longer active. They never, and unless I missed it, they didn't say anything explicitly as to what they were going to be investigating.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to quickly say that I really appreciated Red's comments about Restroom's name and about Brother Jack smiling. And I was just listening to Mr. Millie Fuller today about how racist love for us to be in conflict for one another, with one another, because it brings about a bunch of confusion, and they are able to control us better that way. And going on what I believe it was Mr. Demery Four who brought up the refinement in the North versus the South, and back to Mr. Fuller, I was listening to him, and he also said how he was actually talking about your best friend, your BFF number two, Timothy Wise, and how he don't trust him, and how, like, refined races or the ones who are not saying nigger and all of that explicitly, that they're even more dangerous. And I was thinking about just, like, refinement, like, with and how they're more dangerous, because, like, the people who are refined, you know, if they're saying nigger and hanging people from trees, you're probably not going to let them operate on you or things like that. But the people who are, you know, shaking your hand and who are acting nice and things like that and acting pleasant, those are the people who are going to take your organs or take your cells and steal them without your permission, like they did Henrietta Lacks. And I think that's all I had, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone.
Much obliged, Sister Ivy. We will wrap there next week.
chapter 19. We still have quite a ways to go. It's quite a bit of text left. If you have questions, people did write in. I will share next week. I'll share what people have been writing in before I give my own notes. I do think it's important. I guess this will be a question people can think on, the significance of him, his transfer to the woman's question. What do we think about that? Emasculation? Cowbell? Women's question. And we consistently on this program, women, that does not mean black females. Talking about white women, that's what we've said consistently. We'll see if that holds true, chapter 19. Email untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, comments, gripes about the text, what have you, I will share what people have been writing as we proceed. That's it. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what went down over the past week. That's it. Sobriety still would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing certainly would co-sign on that. Started this week's audio. Brother Jack comes with alcohol. Nothing good is going to happen. Certainly, Dr. Welsing would say, let's take care of our brain computers so that we can express the same type of brilliance that we just read from Ellison in coming up with solutions to the problem, white people. In addition to being sober, if you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every time, driver or passenger. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.